human culture is inculcated with competition. As individuals, we have, I think, a very distorted view, by and large, of what is going on. And that itself is a reflection not only of years of misinformation, but of our own neurological weaknesses. We'll get on to the ideas of Tony Wright. He suggests that the human brain itself is degenerating. Not a happy fit with this story about a world getting better and better, but if you check the historical record, the human brain used to be larger than it is now. Do we think that's important? And I'm going to be looking forward to a global reconciliation, a swords to plowshares moment. Now, we are going to get on to that in just a minute, but we're going to continue now with some new material on the show. This is Amy Baker Benjamin on an important word, I think, she calls alternativism.
And this notion of alternativists I found interesting. Can you explain it a little for us?
Alternativism is simply a skepticism about accounts of events, explanations for events that are offered by a government. A suspicion as to whether what the government is saying is true. Those of us who come from England or the Commonwealth or the United States, the roots of our political system are to be found in a deep skepticism of government, rooted in what I call a Lockean distrust. We're always prepared for a revolution because the state is always potentially a monster. That's John Locke, who first dignified the right of revolution by saying, you know, if the state transgresses or stomps on your natural rights, you do have the right to rise up. The Americans took Locke and really drove it home with their Constitution and their Bill of Rights, and they created the separation of powers with all the checks and balances because they were very unsure that government officials would use their powers within the limits prescribed. So there's a deep distrust in our political system, and what alternativism, in a sense, just carries that not to the macro-institutional level but to the micro-level, so that when governments offer explanations, we realize the potential conflicts of interest. We realize that governments have a hard time policing themselves, and so we're dubious of government accounts. And alternativism really took off in the wake of the Kennedy assassination. Many will know that skepticism about the conclusions of the Warren Report emerged almost immediately. And so alternative accounts based on alternative investigations were offered. And since then, the whole field of political alternativism has just bourgeoned, blossomed.
And note that I'm not only talking about official government pronouncements. Other agents controllable by the deep state are used to try to bolster this narrative. So, for example, academics have spent a lot of time and effort on conspiracism, so-called, in an effort to try and slander this term conspiracy theorist and suggest that conspiracy theorists are just deranged individuals who hold these ideas because they're somehow mentally deficient. A lot of these papers are self-contradictory, so some say it's because they want to stand out and show that they're smarter than everyone else. Others say it's because they want to fit in into their little subculture. But none of the academics that I've ever read about conspiracy theory have devoted any attention to the truth or otherwise of these theories. To be fair, many of them do mention that sometimes conspiracy theories turn out to be true. But this is just a footnote, basically, to the main article, which is how crazy people are for believing this stuff. Well, considering the academics themselves are paid to turn out this stuff, I think it's pretty rich that they claim, oh, conspiracy theorists are just trying to make a buck by attracting gullible people to buy their stuff. They're also very inconsistent on what is a conspiracy theory. So if you say 19 Muslim men conspired, that's not a conspiracy theory, apparently. Whereas if you say Kennedy was killed by agents of the deep state, that is a conspiracy theory. Other authors say, now, conspiracy theory is only a marginal held belief, a fringe belief on the edge of society, although that approach doesn't somehow get applied to the Kennedy assassination. That's just an anomaly, that most people, including the U.S. House Select Committee on Assassinations, all understood that Kennedy was killed as a result of a conspiracy. Somehow, all these different inconsistent logics stuck in a pot, stirred, out comes these papers on conspiracy theory. It has the form of academic rigor, but none of the substance. It's not a concerted effort to find the truth, but exactly the opposite. And it does that by taking contradictory meanings and bringing them under one hood. Well, this is what a conspiracy theory is, except when it's something else, and we're not going to tell you which it is. I noted another example of this semantic inversion last week when I went to a website which compared Wikispooks with similar sites, and it referred to those sites as competitors. Although, as far as I'm concerned, if they have a similar purpose as Wikispooks, if they're also helping people to try and ask themselves what they do and what they don't believe and subjecting official accounts to critical inquiry, then they're allies rather than competitors. So interesting that in the modern world it is just assumed that somebody who's doing what you're doing is competing with you. Why is that? It seems to me they may be competing for money. And in the modern business arena, money is assumed to be more important than the activities one is engaged in to try and procure that. And does it matter that we call them competitors rather than allies, or that the term competitive has somehow acquired such positive connotations that we can have government ministries for competitiveness? I think it matters deeply. This is new material to the show. This is an interview of Alfie Cohn by Open Mind on the ubiquitous competition of Western society, how it got to be that way, and does it matter?
Life for us has become an endless succession of contests. From the moment the alarm clock rings until sleep overtakes us again, from the time we are toddlers until the day we die, we are busy struggling to outdo others. This is our posture at work and at school, on the playing field, and back at home. It is the common denominator of American life. True or false? True, of course. Good or bad? Well, that's what I want to discuss today with Alfie Cohn, the author of Houghton Mifflin's new book, No Contest, The Case Against Competition. Mr. Cohn begins his book with the paragraph I read and goes on with no holds barred to describe, as he notes, why we lose in our race to win. Indeed, what I suspect must always be the fiercest competition of them all, for the minds of men, Mr. Cohn is no slouch himself. I even watched him on the Phil Donahue show recently trying to win his point, which he states so well in No Contest. Let me just read another paragraph. Thus it is that Vince Lombardi's famous comment, "Winning isn't everything, it's the only thing," must be understood not merely as the expression of one football coach's fanaticism, but as a capsule description of our entire culture. Our lives are not merely affected by, but structured upon, the need to be better than. We seem to have reached a point where doing our jobs, educating our children, and even relaxing on the weekends have to take place in the context of a struggle where some must lose. That there might be other ways to do these things is hard for us to imagine, or rather it would be hard if we were sufficiently reflective about our competitiveness to think about alternatives in the first place. Mostly we just accept it as the way life is. Mr. Cohn, isn't life that way?
Well, life in this culture certainly is that way. From our earliest days, we are trained not only to compete, but to believe in competition, to believe it's necessary for productivity, to believe that it builds character, and even to believe that it's inherent to being human, that it's built into our nature. Life itself doesn't have to be that way. We may be driven innately to achieve, to prosper, to survive, but those don't have to be construed as activities we do against other people, trying to beat them. That is a cultural prejudice, and I know of no other culture which drives the point home in such an exaggerated fashion as our own.
371.
Freedom is promised to the people, but its opposite, control, is delivered. We have a nation of credulous followers, celebrity worshippers, and vicarious livers, because we were trained to be such as children. Gatto traces the project of social engineering from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the desire for a mass-produced culture compatible with a mass-produced economy. Curtis focuses on paranoid and alienated theories of human nature and behavior that stemmed from Cold War think tanks and the doctrine of mutually assured destruction, and their diffusion into areas of thought and practice from economics to psychiatry. This resulted in this view of human nature becoming the standard of normalcy. It centered around the idea that individuals were motivated by what was called, quote, rational self-interest, though it is in fact neither rational nor in our interest. Were that indeed the basis of our nature, we would have been extinct long ago, and the fact that we're now so perilously close to extinction should be an indication of how maladaptive and irrational our so-called civilization is. I'd like to begin by reading you an article that illustrates the outcome of this twisted freedom quite well.
662.
A good deal of modern American culture is an extended experiment in the effects of depriving people of what they crave most. In other words, what we are channeled into by this system is substitute satisfaction. Because what human beings want is what they've always wanted. Community, friendship, sex, interesting things to think about, safety. Those things are permanent. And what this system does is it takes those away and says, here's a cell phone. Here's lip gloss. Here's television. It gives you stuff that basically is crap. And it says you'll be happy with that. And generally people aren't on some level. And that's part of the crisis, really.
And the system also disconnects people from how these products are actually manufactured.
The only part of the materials economy we see is the shopping. The extraction, production, and disposal all happens outside of our field of vision.
Now, this disconnection with reality and encouragement of an unhealthy psyche begins at an early age. 537.
Distinction making is equated with intelligence itself. And for a kid, with worthwhileness itself, which is a terrible thing, a terrible, disgraceful thing, a perfect example of the bad faith of the adult world to its own children.
Another one of the audiobooks that we produce during the show, Deschooling Society by Ivan Illich, begins like this, and we broadcast it in episode 562.
Deschooling Society. Chapter 1. Why we must disestablish school. Many students, especially those who are poor, intuitively know what the schools do for them. They school them to confuse process and substance. Once these become blurred, a new logic is assumed. The more treatment there is, the better are the results, or escalation leads to success. The pupil is thereby schooled to confuse teaching with learning, grade advancement with education, a diploma with competence, and fluency with the ability to say something new. His imagination is schooled to accept service in place of value. Medical treatment is mistaken for health care, social work for the improvement of community life, police protection for safety, military poise for national security, the rat race for productive work, health, learning, dignity, independence, and creative endeavour are defined as little more than the performance of those institutions which claim to serve these ends, and their improvement is made to depend on allocating more resources to the management of hospitals, schools, and other agencies in question. In these essays, I will show that the institutionalization of values leads inevitably to physical pollution, social polarization, and psychological impotence, three dimensions in a process of global degradation and modernized misery. I will examine how this process of degradation is accelerated when non-material needs are transformed into demands for commodities, when health, education, personal mobility, welfare, or psychological healing are defined as the results of services or treatments. I do this because I believe that most of the research now going on about the future tends to advocate further increases in the institutionalization of values, and that we must define conditions which would permit precisely the contrary to happen.
Illich there, underlining as usual just how wide a perspective of opinions there is on how society would best function. Before we go too far down the road of discussing failing schools, is the institution itself moribund? And if there's one thing I think we can all agree on we want to see less of, and that's war. Now that's interesting, considering we're now having war on this, war on that, and war on the other. We're using that as a metaphor. Well, let's hear about the reality of actual war from Chris Hedges now, speaking from episode 306.
I have spent most of my adult life in war. I began 2 decades ago covering wars in Central America, where I spent 5 years, then the Middle East, where I spent 7, and the Balkans, where I covered the wars in Bosnia and Kosovo. My life has been marred, let me say deformed, by the organized industrial violence that year after year was an intimate part of my existence. I have watched young men bleed to death on lonely Central American dirt roads and cobblestone squares in Sarajevo. I have looked into the eyes of mothers keening over the lifeless and mutilated bodies of their children. I have stood in warehouses with rows of corpses, including children, and breathed death into my lungs. I carry within me the ghosts of those I worked with, my comrades, now gone. We make our heroes out of clay. We laud their gallant deeds and give them uniforms with colored ribbons on their chest for acts of violence they commit or endure. They are our repositories of glory and honor, of power, self-righteousness, patriotism, and self-worship, all that we want to believe about ourselves. They are our plaster saints of war, the icons we cheer to defend us and make us and our nation great. But they are part of our civic religion, our love of power and force, our belief in our right as a chosen nation to wield this force against the weak and rule. This is our nation's idolatry of itself, and it has corrupted our religious institutions just as it has corrupted religious institutions in other nations, fusing the will of God with the will of the state to create a potent and deadly form of idolatry.
642.
Desperation is the English way. The time is gone, the song is over. Thought I'd something more to say.
Self-emancipation. What Wilberforce is there to bring that about? The mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation.
Now, I wish those words didn't ring quite so true in the 21st century. Some of the desperation, I think, comes from an inability to understand the problem, and that's really what I'm hoping to address. Through this production, I'm trying to deconstruct and confound the ongoing operation to confuse black with white. So as an example, let's hear my analysis of the word professional and professionalism. This is from episode 530. I'm trying to explore a sort of internal semantic divide and conquer mechanism where people are given different meanings, contrary meanings, all attached within a single word.
The idea of professionalism, professional with a terrible triple meaning. On the one hand, it's good to be professional because it's a higher quality. Think about office professional or office home edition. On another hand, a professional is somebody who works for money. And another meaning of professionalism is the ability to disregard your personal values, to do whatever it is whoever is paying you has asked you to do. So to put those three meanings into one word reveals a distressed and divided nature. Like talking about work-life balance, as if work is not life.
Another example of black and white and semantic inversion that came to me last night was the bum-proof bench. This is purportedly an example of defensive architecture. Now, when I first heard that phrase, I imagined sort of tiny windows in medieval castles. A defensive architecture is going to help defend you from the attackers. Not so the bum-proof bench, which you may have seen them, I dare say you have. You possibly haven't noticed, unless you were homeless, how hard modern benches tend to be to sleep on. They're deliberately designed to let you roll off, to put not arm rests. They're not for resting your arms on, they're to stop you lying down across it. And this is called a bum-proof bench, not because it's proof against a human posterior, but because it repels undesirables. People who are stigmatized because they haven't collaborated with the capitalist system to the extent of having property in which to sleep. They're denied even the chance to sleep on benches, as if the act of gaining a free night's sleep without paying for it was somehow diminishing the welfare of the people who put the benches there. This is a manifestation of the zero-sum mentality, the all-against-all, which has been internalized. Some of these benches go as far as having mechanical metal spikes that pop up. So this is sort of pretty medieval in its nature, and still manages to reserve the tag defense rather than attack. I think it's a way to think about the entire defense industry. How can you have a defensive nuclear weapon? And I reject the whole defense industry. My children at school were interested to hear that the defense department used to be called the War Department. My cynical old perspective, I thought, well, it's a single word, that's an easy change. The PR companies got onto them and said, we need a rebranding here, chap. But the reality of defense industry is that it's a war industry. If those weapons, which were produced at such expense, could not be sold at even greater expense, they wouldn't be produced. And if your number one export product is weapons, what's your marketing strategy? The US military-industrial complex, as all military-industrial complexes, is predicated upon perpetual war. Does this perhaps explain why, although the UN is nominally devoted to world peace, its most privileged members, the permanent members of the Security Council, are also home to the world's richest arms companies? Well, I hope this program has helped you to see how common that pattern of semantic inversion actually is in the modern world. For some deeper insights into what's going on, let's hear from Marvin Bram from episode 537. We're going to hear more from this episode. He's explaining about univocity, the single focus, unambiguous, hierarchical aspect of modern society.
Univocity will refer to a constellation of mental and activities, verbal performances, and social behaviors are characterized by precision, by single meanings, by getting down to the right word, to the right and most precise job description ad nauseam.
Now, what's so important about univocity to the deep state? Well, I'm going to build up that idea in due course, but the main point as I see it is that if people can be reduced to a computer-like function carrying out of orders, then it becomes very easy to subvert their natural intelligence, their natural care for the environment, desire to have good relationships with those around them, and so forth. If, as an employer, you tell people, I'm paying you to assume black is white, then there's a tremendous pressure on people to work as if black is white. It's no sense on an individual, personal level. Our senses tell us another thing, but as we shall hear, human beings are not always as sapiens as they would like to make themselves out. Self-delusion plays a big part in this. We continue with more from Marvin Bram from 537.
Being in a job with a particular description, that doesn't upset me very much. It's true. It's true that I like to read and run and play the oboe and play with my kids. But at work, all I do is differential equations. And in fact, given the economy, you know, higher productivity, I have to work a 60-hour week. That's the way it is. So I don't really have time to do any of those things. So I'm a contracted person. I'm like a word with merely one meaning. On this side, it looks as if that person, hypothetical me, has all this stuff, does all these things in a day, does them all. A person of many meanings, of many definitions. If a word has many meanings, how in the world are you going to build an elegant syntactic structure and a powerful logistic structure? How? You can't. Because the word will shift its meanings on you. Here, we have protean meanings. That being the case, I can no longer rely upon my sentence holding together, and I simply cannot build arguments. Now, the first thing someone might say is, you can't build a culture that way. You can't make a life. Wrong. Wrong. It's true that one of the projects of cultures that live over here is to eradicate cultures that live over here. That doesn't mean that people cannot live successfully that way. As a matter of fact, we will see that persons did extremely well over a very long period of time, assuming that this is the whole of the human endowment and not just this.
Now, I wish I had the video for that talk, but I think what Marvin Bram is saying is that polysemous cultures, cultures with many meanings, ambiguous social roles, attract the animosity of unifical cultures, of hierarchical, unambiguous, left-brain-dominated cultures. If that is indeed what he's saying, that gives me a whole new lens with which to understand the imperial domination project. How could I have missed that? Well, we're going to hear a little bit now. These are some reflections on humans' abilities to miss the bigger picture. Our culture gives us blinders. We have prejudices which can be exploited, a kind of hypnotism, to hide people in organizations from the true effects and even the true purposes as to why those organizations were set up. 642.
The greater part of what my neighbors call good, I believe in my soul to be bad. And if I repent of anything, it is very likely to be my good behavior.
I don't want to go to Toronto. I don't want to go.
I don't want to go to Toronto. I don't want to go. All of the blocks are square. None of the streets are twisted. None of the
they decided that they would
bricks.
Only assign agents right out of the FBI Academy to the task force. And it seemed almost to me a deliberate attempt to obstruct or to make the investigation fail.
Donuts made of edible oil.
This investigation had nothing to do with Arabic, did it?
No, not at all. I believe that was just a politically motivated attempt to stymie the investigation.
There's a tower in Toronto that controls people's minds. All of the children in Toronto must wear suits, even the girls, three-piece suits.
But that is an operation of the market group mind. Any facts which do not fit its assumptions are preconsciously inverted and reversed so that they do.
I don't want to go.
Those who were in senior leadership,
Toronto, they have a special.
They decided.
They have it removed surgically. There's a tax on.
What do you think about the possibility that the person who would be behind this would also be able to stifle the investigation in the FBI?
Girls in suits running around with.
I don't think that was a possibility.
The kids don't have names. They have numbers which are assigned to them at birth. They're called 387.7, 412.9.
This is my first time at Davos, and I find it quite a bewildering experience, to be honest. I mean, 1,500 private jets have flown in here to hear Sir David Attenborough speak about, you know, how we're wrecking the planet.
I don't want to go to the hospital. I don't want to go to Toronto. I don't want to go.
What demon possessed me when I behaved so well?
And, I mean, I hear people talk in the language of participation and justice and equality and transparency. But then, I mean, almost no one raises the real issue of tax avoidance, right? And of the rich just not paying their fair share. I mean, it feels like I'm at a firefighters conference and no one's allowed to speak about water. I mean, this is not rocket science. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can talk for a very long time about all these stupid philanthropy schemes. We can invite Bono once more. But come on, we got to be talking about taxes.
Yeah.
That's it. Taxes, taxes, taxes. All the rest is bullshit, in my opinion.
That was historian and author Rutger Breckmann speaking his truth about the Davos experience. And now let's hear Annie Leonard from 534 on the importance of keeping consumers busy recycling waste, while the companies themselves never actually think very hard about this problem.
For every one garbage can of waste you put out on the curb, 70 garbage cans of waste were made upstream just to make the junk in that one garbage can you put out on the curb. So even if we could recycle 100% of the waste coming out of our households, it doesn't get to the core of the problems.
So that is all I've got to say, really, about green consumerism, the idea that by intelligent consumer choices, we can change this system. I'm reminded of a graffito from the 1960s that if voting made any difference, they would have made it illegal. Now we return to Marvin Bram.
Our distinctions are often the distinctions of the shopping center. We make distinctions between bargains and non-bargains, and between this object at this price, that object at another price. Distinctions lie at the heart of buying and selling, and that, by the way, is no coincidence. The linkage between the proliferation and enforcement of distinction-making as a habit of mind and buying and selling is a very close, and in fact, in at different moments in the life of a number of cultures, decisive.
So we've heard about how the money system makes people selfish. I think it also encourages narrow thinking by embracing left-brain logic. There it is, in front of us, in black and white, on a spreadsheet. We know the answer, the bottom line. So we don't see relationships. We don't appreciate that none of these numbers are actually inherent in the real world. They're abstractions. Number itself is an abstraction. So did it occur to these people who've flown in their private jets to discuss global warming that they might be the subject of ridicule on grounds of obvious hypocrisy? Well, perhaps it did. Perhaps their PR consultants said, why not take an ordinary jet? And perhaps they just felt so privileged they said, well, who cares what people think? I don't know. But I think the fact that it was the World Economic Forum where they talk about trying to save nature sort of predisposes everybody not to relate to nature, but to think of it as a series of resources which must be managed using the sort of divide and conquer left brain. I think this really helps us to confuse black and white because it's sort of the difference between a mathematical proof. If you've done a maths equation and you make one slip, well, you're not going to get the right answer. It tends to be that that just carries straight down the line. So if you have a command hierarchy for somebody telling somebody to tell somebody to do something, and one of those communications fails, whether accidentally or because you have a deep state operative who's undercover and changes the brief, well, then you've just subverted the original intention. So as compared to, say, a picture of a landscape where, yeah, even if you spill some ink on the paper, you didn't just suddenly reverse the meaning of what you've done. So there's a different way of relating, and the contexts, the multiple meanings, the polysemy, the ambiguities that the bigger picture brain handles fairly robustly are just not available. Another analogy would be peripheral vision, where you see something move, you can instantly zoom in on it with focused vision, which gives you a clear indication. So the sort of the two, when your vision systems are working together, you have capabilities which are greater than either of them, as if you had this sort of pinpoint accuracy across your whole visual field. And are we perhaps in the West, particularly because of not only the environment we've built, but the day-to-day lives that people lead, busy thinking about performance indicators and job descriptions and targets, rather than, for example, looking at the plants that they're growing, wondering what they're going to eat tonight. So we have a very abstract and relatively lifeless world. So from the point of view of the deep state, left brain centered thinking is more logical, more predictable, more subject to mass production, not aware of context, less spontaneous. So for a whole bunch of reasons, there's a synergy, a feedback mechanism, if you like, between the sort of mechanistic control, albeit based on lies. That's fine. If people are within a small framework, they won't pick up those lies. If you compartmentalize what's going on, you can tell people to be a part of something they don't understand, and the left brain doesn't twig because it's got this capability to sort of deceive itself. And that's not to say the glitches don't occur, but when people feel disempowered, what are they going to do about glitches? We're going to hear now from a spectacular glitch in The Matrix to do with the Brabant massacres, part of Operation Gladio. This is from episode 561.
Many of the people that have been organising these terrorist attacks from NATO headquarters in Brussels over the decades are still working there.
The case of the Brabant massacres. The case was that in the 80s, you know, people went shopping in Belgium in the supermarkets, and then you had a group of people, armed, specially trained men, not small robbers who hit you and then run away, but specially armed and specially trained men who came with their cars, stopped in front of the supermarkets, and shot down the people who were there shopping. They didn't even take much money. And you know, some people were running and crying, say, that's my child, and they just killed them, cold-blooded. And in some other instances, the police, who was alarmed and raced to the crime scene, they didn't run away from the police. They even waited for the police to come and shot them too. So they acted like special forces soldiers in a war. There's something very wrong going on here. And when the Belgian Senate heard in 1990 that in Italy that you had the secret army linked to NATO, which was discovered, you had the Belgian defense minister, Guy Coëm, who flew back from Rome. He happened to be in Italy. So he flew back to Belgium and asked his chief of staff, do we have a secret army in Belgium too? I know nothing about it. And then his chief of staff, which is the highest ranking military in Belgium, said, yes, we have such a secret army. And they said, why don't I know anything about it? And then he said, well, we need an investigation into this whole matter, and we need to find out whether our secret army was linked to these attacks on our population, you know, and whether NATO had anything to do with it. So the Belgian Senate set up a special group of parliamentarians who had to investigate this story. And the incredible thing is that the Secret Service in Belgium just refused to hand out the names. They just didn't give the names of the people who were involved in the Secret Army.
So, a remarkable, but not actually unprecedented, glitch in the Matrix. When Daniel Aganza himself asked NATO for information about Gladio, they initially denied all knowledge, and then said that was incorrect, and then didn't say anything else. And the EU Parliament agreed all member countries would set up an inquiry into Gladio in their country, and I think I'm right in saying only 5 or 6 countries ever did that, thus showing who's really holding the cards. And we're now going to hear from episode 537, From Divided Brains to Divided Societies, on the neurological and cultural roots of separation.
For reason, you need both hemispheres. To do a kind of very schematic, rationalistic processing like a computer would, you can use your left hemisphere. But to reason fully, you need both hemispheres. And a lot of mathematical thinking and deduction is done in the right hemisphere. So if I had to sum it up, I'd say the world of the left hemisphere, dependent on denotative language and abstraction, yields clarity and power to manipulate things that are known, fixed, static, isolated, decontextualized, explicit, disembodied, general in nature, but ultimately lifeless.
319.
We don't have to be polluters to undermine this planet. We have only to simplify it. We have only to replace soil by sand, vegetation by concrete, trees by steel buildings or reinforced concrete structures, eating up our best arable land. We have only to spread over this planet and simplify it.
Ultimately lifeless. The right hemisphere, by contrast, yields a world of individual, changing, evolving, interconnected, implicit, incarnate, living beings within the context of the lived world, but in the nature of things never fully graspable, never perfectly known, as we think. And to this world, it exists in a certain relationship, rather than just an objective stance. The knowledge that's mediated by the left hemisphere is, however, within a closed system. It has the advantage of perfection, but the perfection is bought ultimately at the price of emptiness, of self-reference. It can mediate knowledge only in terms of a mechanical rearrangement of other things it already knows.
683.
Modern science seems to have failed in testing the one piece of equipment it uses, our only instrument of scientific inquiry, and everything else is our mind, is our brain. It designs the experiments, it interprets the data, and that's one thing that modern science has presumed is working, which is, of course, as I'm sure you know, is bad science. We should have at least checked the equipment before we started using it. And that's never been done, to the best of my knowledge. So I'd actually lay the gauntlet down and say, hang on a minute. So it's a fairly complete theory now. It has been since about 1998. If our neurological system isn't as functional as we think, if that's driving our behavior, our thoughts, our psychology, and the world we create, and let's face it, it's not difficult to find evidence of humans behaving a bit strangely and a bit crazily, it could take us to a causality that's pretty much been missed in modern science, where, well, actually, if the structure of our brain doesn't develop properly, of course we're going to have endless problems perceiving reality, diagnosing what's going on, and coming up with appropriate responses. And clearly we don't do that. You know, we're in a terrible mess.
There are literally two sides to your theory. One is that the dysfunctional left side is dominating our thinking. The other part of that theory is that the right hemisphere of the brain is inherently more brilliant than the left side, right?
Yeah.
And if you think about this virtuality, tokens for things, I really would like to read you this short extract about a whole series of patients. This was research done by a very prominent neuroscientist called Marcel Ginzburn and a Russian colleague called Deglin, when they looked at how people reasoned. They gave them false syllogisms, and that means one of the premises is wrong, and what deduction do you draw? So, major premise, all monkeys climb trees. Minor premise, the porcupine is a monkey. Which clearly it isn't. Implied conclusion, the porcupine climbs trees. Well, does it? They just demonstrated each hemisphere has its own way of approaching this question. At the outset of the experiment, when the intact individual is asked, does the porcupine climb trees? She replies, using, of course, both hemispheres, it doesn't climb, the porcupine runs on the ground, it's prickly, it's not a monkey. During experimental temporary hemisphere inactivations, the left hemisphere of the very same individual, with the right hemisphere knocked out, replies that the conclusion is true. The porcupine climbs trees, since it's a monkey. When the experimenter asks, but is the porcupine a monkey? She replies she knows it's not. When the syllogism is presented again, however, she's a little nonplussed, but replies in the affirmative, since that's what's written on the card. When the right hemisphere of the same individual is asked if the syllogism is true, she replies, how can it climb trees? It's not a monkey. It's wrong here. So there's that. And there's another very important thing about the left hemisphere. It's a huge optimist, and it indulges in a degree of denial. So great is this denial. This is a neurological fact. It's not just an opinion I have about the left hemisphere. If somebody had a stroke involving the left-hand side of the body, their right hemisphere not operating, because it doesn't fit with the left hemisphere's idea of itself that there could be anything wrong with it, it will deny that there's a problem. It's not paralyzed at all. We'll move it then, and no movement will happen. But the patient will insist that they've just moved their arm. I just wanted to read you this little extract. So, an examiner talking to a patient. Whose arm is this? That's pointing to the paralyzed arm. It's not mine. Whose is it? It's my mother's. How on earth does it happen to be here? I don't know, I found it in my bed. And so on. And then there's a procedure whereby you can temporarily activate the right hemisphere. She goes back to completely accepting that she's got a paralyzed arm, but once that wears off, she goes back to, it's my mother's, nothing to do with me, Gov. So there's something there which is really extraordinary happening.
Extraordinary, yes, but also inherent, it would seem, in the human neural system. Does this perhaps yield some insight into the rich potential for exploitation by propagandists and advertisers, which has been minutely studied over the last century? 534.
This story is typical of what happens when you test bottled water against tap water. Is it cleaner? Sometimes, sometimes not. In many ways, bottled water is less regulated than tap. Is it tastier? In taste tests across the country, people consistently choose tap over bottled water. These bottled water companies say they're just meeting consumer demand. But who would demand a less sustainable, less tasty, way more expensive product, especially when you can get for almost free in your kitchen? Bottled water costs about 2,000 times more than tap water. Can you imagine paying 2,000 times the price of anything else? How about a $10,000 sandwich? Yet people in the U.S. buy more than 500 million bottles of water every week.
Now, while we're on the subject of water, this is new material on the show from 2019, a podcast put out by an academic journal.
The paper is about fluoride and maternal fluoride exposure during pregnancy and its effects upon IQ scores of children at ages 3 and 4, which in itself is like a shocking title because I had never known that there was even any concern that maternal fluoride use might affect children's IQ.
Right. In fact, for me, before they were anti-vaxxers, there were sort of anti-fluoriders.
Right.
And like the traditional teaching when I was going through residency and my early professional career was that fluoride is completely safe. All these people that are trying to take it out of the water are nuts. It's the best thing that's ever happened for children's dental health, and we just need to push back and get it into every water system.
Right. One of our mutual mentors is Abe Bergman,
yeah.
And one of the first things he ever worked on in terms of public health was getting the fluoridated law passed in Washington State.
Right. So when I first saw this title, my initial inclination was, what the hell?
Yes.
So go ahead, Fred, set up the paper.
So this was a prospective study where these researchers collected two measures of maternal exposure to fluoride, or actually three. So they collected maternal urinary fluoride levels across three trimesters, and they averaged those. They also did a questionnaire to ask them about maternal fluoride consumption, both in drinking water and in other sources. I didn't realize that actually drinking tea, which I drink a lot of, has a high level of fluoride.
Yeah, that was interesting.
And then they also looked at whether there was fluoride in the community water supply. And they were able to follow these women and their children, 512 pairs, through pregnancy and to age 3 to 4. And at age 3 and 4, they then did IQ testing on these children. So first of all, they found out that there were really quite a large number of mothers living in non-fluoridated areas. 369 mother-child pairs and 228 were living in non-fluoridated areas. I'd say that this was from Canada, and they picked some large cities in Canada. These were Montreal, Vancouver, Kingston, Toronto, Hamilton, and Halifax. So I'm a little surprised that those places did not have fluoridated water supplies.
You wonder whether it's the entire municipal water system or sub-areas of it. I mean, it wasn't clear, and obviously it's a separate issue, but
and,
yeah.
And the other interesting thing that came out, like in the editorial and in this paper, was that in Europe, only 3% of municipal water supplies are fluoridated.
Right. So again, this was to me sort of eye-opening that, you know, I sort of thought like this was
everyone
did it. Certainly all developed countries, everyone that was at any level of sophistication was putting fluoride in the water and because they weren't falling victim to these concerns that it was a bad thing.
Well, we do all do this. You've got to do this. We can't know everything about everything, and we have to infer. We have to make some reasonable assumptions. I think there's nothing wrong with that as such. The problems come when a deliberate effort is made to exploit people's tendency to assume things. I think this does have to do with the left brain's tendency to just discount things that it doesn't want to be true. So, no, that's not my leg there. No, I'm not paralyzed. And there's material evidence right under our noses, and yet somehow the brain just doesn't take that on board. So how interesting that Americans assumed, well, of course, Europeans, being such developed countries, will all fluoridate their water. And how interesting that I was pretty surprised to hear it was as low as 3%. Yeah, these sort of contradictions, without an easy access to information, they're going to persist because everybody in one area will think one thing, everybody in one area will think something else, and nobody will notice that they think different things. If we, as a planet, are going to have to make a judgment call, do we want to have race-specific bioweapons? Do we want to have... If we're going to have to face environmental challenges which are not confined to any one border, but which affect the entire surface of the globe, then let's have information systems which allow information to flow, because we are one planet. Let's have one repository of information, but let's not have an easy system to manipulate, which is exactly what we do have at the moment. If we have a small number of people who can be prevailed upon to spread lies. And anyway, why not have a large number of people who can input information to the system? And don't tell me about Wikipedia. That's another whole place that I don't want to go. But the summary there is, it's the same as corporate media. They have quite deliberately extended corporate media control into Wikipedia. So I'm looking at something more democratic than that. And anything that doesn't really change the way money works is going to hit trouble, for all the reasons that we've looked at, the deleterious effect of money, the divide and conquer, the perpetual scarcity. So now with that little rant, well, it was an opportunity. I just thought, let's chip in here. Let's return to, does fluoride actually affect boys and girls in the womb? And I suspect the answer is going to surprise you. It certainly surprised me.
Because they weren't falling victim to these concerns that it was a bad thing.
Right.
Indeed, they were not. So what they followed these kids, and what they found was, I think, fairly surprising. Now, I have a little concerns about the paper.
Well, we'll get to that, but tell us the findings.
All right. The overall finding was that, as you would expect, the mothers who lived in fluoridated areas had a higher fluoride concentration in their urine and a higher fluoride concentration intake during pregnancy than mothers who lived in the non-fluoridated areas. And there seemed to be an effect upon their kids' IQ. Now, this effect was only seen in boys, where a 1 milligram per liter increase in the maternal urinary fluoride concentration was associated with a 5-point lower score on the boy's IQ.
Right. And effect size, which is sizable.
Which is sizable.
On par with lead.
And with that timely reminder of historical inability to judge risk, let's have 663.
Managing the climate, one way or another, is humanity's great challenge for the 21st century. Just how confident are we that we can use technology to take control of and regulate the biggest and most complex ecosystem of them all?
Do we think that the human reservoir of knowledge and experience is sufficient that we should try to impose it on the external world? Or are we going to look at the external world and ask ourselves the question, is this human society that seems so important to us, is that a good reflection of who we truly are?
All the microorganism, all the microorganism. Dive in the gene pool, down you swim, down to where the light grows dim.
We're now going to hear from Tony Wright, who has an explanation for human neurological degeneration. This is just one aspect of his ideas, one that would suggest that we might be healthier if we ate more fruit, not only in a physiological but a neurological or psychological fashion. And this is from 683.
The primary effect was the loss of these chemicals that are called flavonoids, the sort of give the coloration to things, particularly fruit, you know, thousands of different chemicals that give it the reds and the yellows and so on. I think that was the primary effect, the loss of these chemicals. I think the addition of less helpful dietary elements certainly compounded the issue, particularly in more recent times.
537.
So are we tending more and more to the left hemispheres for some evolutionary reason?
Oh, there is definitely selective pressure on left hemisphere development, because as I pointed out, it's the thing about the man with the hammer, he finds everything is a nail. Once you start looking at things a certain way, that's all that you ever find. And we're getting more and more into what I call the hall of mirrors. And we've now actually started to construct an environment around us which expresses the left hemisphere's view of the world. So we're actually getting feedback from the environment, which is very much of the left hemisphere's world, which locks us in.
Marvin Bram is the one who makes a connection between left brain dominated cultures and violence, and historically looking at the roots of what could be called modern global culture, stemming from empire after empire, stemming from what's called the cradle of civilization. I mean, this is not terribly new thinking. A lot of tribal cultures understand that there is this tension and seem to consciously manage to keep it in balance. Marvin Bram talks about the importance of size on the culture and the fact that beyond a certain point, people are unable to understand one another's different perspectives on the world. If the hierarchy becomes too large, the group becomes too far-reaching in its distance, socially speaking, then the people at the top really don't give a damn about the people at the bottom, because they can't understand their lives, and according to left brain thinking, they see themselves as completely separate.
So that separateness is manifest in economic, legal, juridical, all kind of systems, which I find it interesting that human biology, being what it is, the female gender has a closer connection to the baby, a more intimate connection, whereas the father relates, not physically, to the same extent. So the males may be more likely to see themselves as separate entities from the next generation. Does this relate to the patriarchy rather than the matriarchy, typical in hierarchical societies? And does our confusion about relationships to others, is that somehow connected to the rise of autism? Is autism on the rise in societies organized in other ways? Which countries have the most dramatic? Seems to me it's the US. And what do we think that's down to? Well, I haven't heard any convincing explanations. I think some of it may be through methods we're not clear on. Maybe chemicals in the environment or electromagnetic radiation. It might be lots of things, but it seems to be a very modern phenomenon associated with developed countries, and these are precisely the countries in which money is helping people to activate the left brain more, suppressing bigger picture, contextual, right brain thinking. For another thought about hemispheric imbalance, we return to 537.
And when I'd finished this book, I came across a quote from Einstein that I wish I'd known when I was writing it. Because it turned out that Einstein's thinking somehow presaged this thing about the structure of the brain. He said, "The intuitive mind is a sacred gift, and the rational mind is a faithful servant. We have created a society that honors the servant, but has forgotten the gift."
So I'm reminded of Thoreau's suggestion that all modern technology is improved means to an unimproved end. If there's one thing I don't think Western society and development can be accused of, it is failing to look into technologies of mass destruction. Let's hear now from an American long exposed to experience of these technologies to report on how they affected him and how they affected others. Does this perhaps help us understand the resonance of the political meme of waging war, whether it's on drugs, immigration, whistleblowers, poor people, or whatever else? So let's hear from Chris Hedges from episode 306 on the addictive nature of war.
There is a constant search in war to find new perversities, new forms of death when the initial flush fades, a rearguard and finally futile effort to ward off the boredom of routine death.
738.
After World War II, they began to think of combat as also a production process. The officer corps were seen not as gladiator heroes who were leading men in combat, but as war managers. In turn, the enlisted men were no longer the citizens of a nation, but they were workers. Managers and workers worked on a production line to produce deaths, and the product then was enemy body counts. So just as American society's strength, supposedly, was high technology, capital-intensive business, so too would we fight wars as high technology, capital-intensive warfare, and we would literally drive the other side bankrupt. So it's this production model of war, or what I call techno-war, that distinguishes, at a primary structural level, Vietnam from other warfare.
So then in this way, we couldn't lose because we were fighting a small, underdeveloped, untechnical third world country with peasants, basically.
Exactly. From an American perspective, if the only thing that counts in warfare is technology and economics, both in your economy and how you translate your economy into your military, then it was impossible for us to lose. It was theoretically impossible for an underdeveloped peasant economy to beat the United States. It just couldn't happen. Therefore, whenever we ran into a problem in 54 or 60 or 64, at every time the U.S. was defeated, we always thought that if we escalated to the next highest level, we would win. It's a closed system.
Well, I don't know about you, but I'm reminded of the neoliberal mantra. We can't stop now because we started. We've got to keep going. This is a very common position used to railroad people to accept things they're trying to reject. Another one is, well, there's nothing we can do. Market forces, law of gravity and all that. You can't fight City Hall.
The boredom of routine death. And this is why we would drive into towns in Bosnia and find bodies crucified on the sides of barns or decapitated and mutilated. This is why those slain in combat are treated as trophies belonging to the killers, turned into grotesque pieces of performance art. I know soldiers that to this day carry in their wallets the identity cards of men they know they killed. They take them everywhere. They show them to you with the imploring look of a lost child. They will never understand. In war, we deform ourselves, our essence. We give up individual conscience, maybe even consciousness, for the contagion of the crowd, the rush of patriotism, the belief that we must stand together as a nation in moments of extremity. To make a moral choice, to defy war's enticement, to challenge the idol and the civic religion, can be self-destructive. But war is necrophilia, and this necrophilia is central to soldiering just as it is central to the makeup of suicide bombers and terrorists. It is hidden under platitudes about duty and comradeship. It waits, especially in moments when we seem to have little to live for and no hope, or in moments when the intoxication of war is at its pitch to be unleashed. And when we spend long enough in war, it comes to us as a kind of release, a fatal and seductive embrace that can consummate the long flirtation with our own destruction. Many of those I worked with as war correspondents during the past 2 decades could not escape. They could not break free from this dance with death. They wandered from conflict to conflict, seeking always one more hit.
735.
We live in a world today where, you know, public discourse has become a tool used to create stories that direct us in a world where we're told, you know, capitalism is the only way to organize our society. For instance, the war can be just and that invasions are righteous. And so there's a lot of things that, unless we are really aware of, you know, how is it that that story is being framed, we feel lost. We're deliberately being misguided.
Well, I think your use of the word story is important, because when we think of the news, we should always remember that there's a bigger story behind it. Take one of the examples you used, capitalism. Whatever the news story of the day, whether it's interest rates going up or the budget or taxes or whatever it might be, there's a bigger story behind it. And one of the key elements of that story in the modern world, in the West, in the developed world especially, but essentially everywhere, is that capitalism is a sort of natural state of being. Well, simple inquiry reveals pretty quickly that's not true. Capitalism is a product of history. It's a product of choices made really over the last 2 or 3 centuries. It's not a natural state of affairs. But if you can tell this bigger story always that capitalism is natural, then there's no way to critique it. And the news stories of the day have to be dealt with within that capitalist frame. So always going back and asking, what are these bigger stories being told? You mentioned war and the whole idea of just war. The idea of bringing peace and stability and justice to Syria is not easy. Let's not be naive about this. But the assumption behind a lot of the news stories is that the West, led by the United States primarily, but including the European nations, even Canada, the assumption is that we make the decisions about what level of violence to use to bring that peace and stability and justice to Syria. There's a sort of larger story about the inherent moral superiority of the West and the right of, therefore, the West to make those decisions. That's the big story we have to contest.
This is new material to the show. This is a speech by David Swanson in 2018 on the anniversary of the Kellogg-Briand Pact. And it's nearly an hour long, and I'm going to broadcast it in its entirety.
And happy Kellogg-Briand Pact Day, by the way. I think, as you all know, but most people do not know, the Peace Pact was signed 91 years ago today. And as you probably know, but most people do not know, the inspiration and the vision and the endless Frank Getz-like labor that was behind the creation of the pact did not come from Mr. Kellogg or from Monsieur Briand, but from a lawyer in Chicago named Salmon Oliver Levinson. You could point that out to Minnesotans from Frank Kellogg's Twin Cities, if you like, if, of course, any of them had ever heard of Frank Kellogg. A long time back, I was asked for a title for this speech today, which I hadn't yet written, and I replied, 10 ways we pretend war is not a crime and how to change them. More recently, I sat down with the hope that I could think of 10 such ways. Unfortunately, far more than 10 items immediately occurred to me. So the following are 10 greatest hits, or broad categories, of the ways in which we pretend that war is not a crime, plus how to change them. As a top 10 list, I will number the items in reverse order. And I may also spend so much time on the first one that you forget it is a list. Nonetheless, number 10. Laws like the Kellogg-Briand Pact are ignored. The pact, which bans all war, is a treaty to which the U.S. government is a party. That makes it the supreme law of the land under the U.S. Constitution. It is a treaty that has not been ended or abolished or withdrawn from. The U.S. State Department website lists it as in effect and 66 nations as party to it. The pact is silent on any means of ending or withdrawing from it. However, the United Nations Charter states, quote, in the event of a conflict between the obligations of the members of the United Nations under the present charter and their obligations under any other international agreement, their obligations under the present charter shall prevail, end quote. This creates the possibility to argue plausibly that the UN Charter replaced the peace pact. But it is an argument that has to be made. It does not exist as specific written law. It is useful to ask what obligations under the UN Charter might conflict with obligations under the Peace Pact of Paris. They cannot possibly be obligations of peace. The Peace Pact requires that all disputes among parties be settled by peaceful means. They also cannot be obligations to uphold the banning of war through legal processes. The Peace Pact, after all, was the basis for the trials in Nuremberg and Tokyo following World War II, and it conflicts with no imaginable peaceful means of upholding peace, many of which were envisioned and advocated for by the people behind the pact's creation. The only conflict could be a UN Charter-based obligation to wage war. That would certainly conflict with the Kellogg-Briand Pact. But the UN Charter does not necessarily oblige any nations to wage war. It does permit them to wage war under certain limited circumstances, as so-called individual or collective self-defense after being attacked and until the United Nations takes action. It also stipulates that agreements will be negotiated with member states for the collective waging of a war whenever decided on by the UN Security Council and to be overseen by the UN Security Council. Those agreements would certainly conflict with the Kellogg-Briand Pact, but this part of the UN Charter is not used and has next to nothing to do with anything we think of as wars. There have been wars approved by the United Nations in Korea and the Persian Gulf, but they have not been led by the United Nations, and the UN Charter has not obliged any governments to take part in them. A more likely source of conflict is in the smaller operations that the UN is pleased to call peacekeeping. But that doesn't get us to the elimination of the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which the wording of the UN Charter appears to leave in place, except where a conflict arises on a case-by-case basis. When the Kellogg-Briand Pact is dismissed as no longer in place or relevant, it is typically not with any legal argument or any mention of the UN Charter, but rather through the claim that the Kellogg-Briand Pact failed. This is a truly bizarre understanding of how laws work. Murder exists, yet we don't declare all laws against murder to have failed and proceed to completely ignore them. We have prisons full of people who violated laws against murder, but empty of anyone who violated laws against war. The UN Charter also bans war, albeit with exceptions, and we do not declare it gone because failed. I am not a lawyer, and I don't want to focus only on a legal argument for the pact still being in place. I readily admit that most lawyers believe or assume that it is not still in place. I further readily admit that it is routinely violated, as is the UN Charter, and that an argument over whether one routinely violated law supersedes another routinely violated law is of limited value. But the problem with ignoring the Kellogg-Briand Pact and the history of its creation and its successes is largely the same whether we need to create compliance with the existing pact or whether we need to recreate and then compel compliance with a new pact. The value lies in the goal of such compliance and in the lessons to be learned from the movement that won over people like Frank Kellogg in the 1920s. The outlawry movement, the movement to outlaw war, was a principled movement that embraced rather than hid from moral arguments and that thought big as a Green New Deal or healthcare or education or an end to mass incarceration, in fact, much bigger than any of those things. Those are all things, after all, that lots of other countries already have. It's simply imagined to be a radical idea for the United States to have them. But nobody had a global agreement to end war. Levinson saw such an agreement as one tool in the abolition of war. And he saw the abolition of war as one step in a chain of progress that included ending things like dueling. The U.S. Senate ratified the Kellogg-Briand Pact and did not attach, as Frank noted, did not amend it and did not attach any reservations to it. However, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee separately declared that it believed the pact allowed war as self-defense. Once again, I readily admit that a law only amounts to what people suppose it is and how they use it. However, there is a common understanding of law that says it should mean what it was supposed to mean by the people who created it. The reason for the separate interpretive statement by the committee was precisely to contradict the treaty itself, which had been drafted and lobbied for by people who wanted to ban all war, not just aggressive war, and who had successfully fended off every effort to limit the actual words of the treaty in that way. Levinson explained himself as follows, quote, "Suppose this same distinction had been urged when the institution of dueling was outlawed. Suppose it had then been urged that only aggressive dueling should be outlawed and that defensive dueling be left intact. Such a suggestion relative to dueling would have been silly, but the analogy is perfectly sound. What we did was to outlaw the institution of dueling, a method theretofore recognized by law for the settlement of disputes of so-called honor." End quote. The U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee of 1929 may have simply been stating the obvious and the inevitable, as many people would say to this day. Outlawing defensive war is insanity, and therefore sane people must point out that insanity wasn't intended. Against this line of thought, however, we must ask why anything obvious should need pointing out. And we must observe that just as the outlawists like Levinson predicted, the concept of defensive war has been used to excuse numerous aggressive wars. Further, we can recognize that recent scholarship finds nonviolent responses to tyranny and occupation to be more successful than violent ones. Preparations for defensive war have proven to be as counterproductive as preparations for defensive dueling, whereas diplomacy, cooperation, aid, respect, the rule of law, and disarmament have reduced war, and in some parts of the world, ended it. The outlawists fail to measure up to that cartoon version of them in which they imagined that the Kellogg-Briand Pact would immediately end all war. Among the many additional steps they wanted to take was outlawing advocacy for war. Levinson drafted legislation to make advocating war a felony. That we have such a law today is another matter of an ignored treaty. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, signed and ratified by the United States government, includes these words, quote, "Any propaganda for war shall be prohibited by law," end quote. You will be shocked to learn that war propaganda is not prohibited by domestic U.S. law. Such a law might conflict with the right to freedom of speech, certainly for an even better reason than that for the prohibition of shouting fire in a crowded theater. Such a law might conflict with the non-legal concept of too big to fail, since it would require major media outlets to radically reform or shut down. But like the Kellogg-Briand Pact, the ban on war propaganda is a law written down in very clear language. When those in power favor something, like the responsibility to protect, or corporate personhood, or the right to torture, or the right to mass surveillance, or the executive order, or assassination. No law seems to be required at all. But when something is not favored, like a ban on war, or a ban on war propaganda, a law seems not to be sufficient. This is only to a degree, of course. Many worthwhile laws are upheld, which is why we bother trying to create and uphold laws. I should add that the U.S. used to have a law banning propaganda, domestic media, meaning that the U.S. government could invent sheer fabrications for audiences outside the U.S., but not for audiences within. But it got rid of that law several years ago, and the nature of today's media renders the distinction very weak or meaningless. But war propaganda, understood as advocacy for war, which is always biased, always misleading, always dishonest, has long been central to both the U.S. government and supposedly independent U.S. media, and has never been banned. Included in domestic propaganda before and since the repealing of that law have been such complete fabrications as Iraqi nuclear weapons, Iranian nuclear weapons, Iraq's responsibility for 9/11, Iran's responsibility for 9/11. You see, the Pentagon is very environmentalist-minded. It recycles all of its propaganda. Even laws that are mocked when not ignored have often done a great deal of good. War was legal in 1927. Both sides of every war were legal. Atrocities committed during wars were almost always legal. The conquest of territory was legal. Burning and looting and pillaging were legal. War was, in fact, not just legal, but understood to be law enforcement. War could be used to attempt to right any perceived injustice. The seizing of other nations as colonies was legal. The motivation for colonies to try to liberate themselves was weak because they were likely to be seized by some other nation if they broke free from their current oppressor. Economic sanctions by neutral nations were not legal, but joining in a war could be. And making trade agreements under the threat of a war was perfectly legal and acceptable, as was starting another war if such a coerced agreement was violated. Raping a woman in war could be illegal, but killing her could be in perfect compliance with the law. Killing was in fact legal whenever deemed part of a war, and generally illegal otherwise. The outlawing of war reduced the need for large nations, and smaller nations began to form by the dozens, exercising their right to self-determination. Colonies sought their freedom. Conquests of territory after 1928 were undone. The year 1928 became the dividing line for determining which conquests were legal and which conquests were not legal. International trade has flourished in the absence of legal conquest. While it is not even true, much less a statement of causation, that nations with McDonald's do not attack each other, it may be true that a world with a reduced risk of attack, for better or worse, generates more McDonald's. The very first prosecutions for the crime of war at Nuremberg and Tokyo have been followed by a reduction in wars that has notably included the absence of any further wars waged directly between wealthy, well-armed nations, at least so far. Sadly, the justice then and ever since has been one-sided. But war has been stigmatized, has been made understood as a crime in much of the world. Just as much of the world celebrates labor rights and a labor day in May with roots in Chicago, despite the U.S. active erasure of that knowledge, much of the world understands war to have been outlawed. And that movement that did that also has roots in Chicago, whether anyone remembers it or not. The consequences of ignoring the Kellogg-Briand Pact in the U.S. are to be seen all over the world. If war were not understood to be legal, the commission of murder by the U.S. military on small and large scales in numerous nations would be understood as the crime of murder. Just as in the pre-Kellogg-Briand times, war is understood by some lawyers, such as Rosa Brooks, as legalizing its constituent parts. She testified to Congress that murders committed with missiles from drones were murder if not part of a war, or legal, if part of a war, and that she had no idea which they were because President Obama had written a memo on the topic but kept it secret. In contrast to this view, and in line with the view of some other lawyers who are not invited to testify before Congress, the judgment at Nuremberg upholding the Kellogg-Briand Pact, while limiting it to wars of aggression, declared that, quote, to initiate a war of aggression is not only an international crime, it is the supreme international crime, differing only from other war crimes in that it contains within itself the evil of the whole, end quote. In other words, a collection of murders and tortures and traumatizing horrors is not made legal by its size, but rather is rendered supremely illegal. Without the notion that war is legal and that lesser acts against so-called enemies are therefore also legal, crimes like sabotaging elections and arming and training coup plotters would be understood as crimes under the laws of the countries where they take place. With the world failing to uphold the Kellogg-Briand Pact, the government of Japan, under U.S. pressure, is able to advance its efforts to remove from its constitution or to reinterpret, to mean their opposite, words nearly identical to those of the peace pact, placed there by the United States, but kept there and upheld for many decades by the Japanese people against every U.S. demand to eliminate or violate them. Number nine. Who remembered that this was a list? Number nine. Laws like the UN Charter that are not ignored or forgotten are circumvented through the use of excuses, pretenses, and obfuscations. In common U.S. understanding, wars are legal if done properly. And properly means involving the United Nations in some vague way, or involving NATO, or rounding up a gang of co-conspirators, as well as being sure only to kill people, not torture them, only use cluster bombs and napalm and depleted uranium, not chemical weapons, declare all your killing to be precise and proportional, and so forth. But that is not what the UN Charter says. The UN Charter echoes the Kellogg-Briand Pact in banning war, but it opens up two small loopholes. Because those loopholes exist, people imagine that wars must be legal, or might be legal, or that it's a matter for lawyers to debate and for everyone to simply choose their preferred opinion on whether a war should be deemed legal or not. In reality, however, the words of the UN Charter say, in part, quote, all members shall settle their international disputes by peaceful means in such a manner that international peace and security and justice are not endangered. All members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state or in any other manner inconsistent with the purposes of the United Nations, end quote. What are the purposes of the United Nations? Well, they are all in line with the very first one, which begins the UN Charter, quote, to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. If the Kellogg-Briand Pact were completely erased from memory, the UN Charter would be the next best thing left. None of the major wars of the past 75 years have been initiated in compliance with the self-defense loophole. None of them have been fought by the United Nations, and almost none have even been approved by the United Nations. When the UN refuses very clearly and publicly to approve a war, such as Iraq 2003, where it did not approve attacking Iraq or approve Iraq fighting back, the war is simply fought anyway. And the claims made, however implausibly, that attacking an unarmed nation halfway around the globe is self-defense, and or that some UN resolution that didn't authorize any war actually did authorize a war, whether the UN thinks so or not. Sometimes when the UN does not authorize a war, such as Afghanistan 2001, it is given a subsidiary role in the endless occupation that follows. And the implausible arguments for meeting one or both of the loopholes hardly need to even be offered. When the UN does not authorize a war on Libya, it is maneuvered into authorizing measures to prevent a supposedly looming massacre, and then the pretense is made, either that the prevention inevitably led to massive bombing and government overthrow and the creation of violent chaos, or the pretense is made that, in fact, the resolution authorized what it did not. and so on for Syria, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, etc. A UN special rapporteur named Ben Emerson, also a law partner of Tony Blair's wife, wrote a big report some years back on drone murders, in which he declared that they had simply made war the normal state of affairs instead of peace. Nothing criminal, mind you, just a curious alteration in the state of affairs, so that war is now the norm. Presumably the UN or some successor institution will have to establish the practice of authorizing peace in isolated locations. Interestingly, Ben Emerson, who is played by Ralph Fiennes, known for Schindler's List and Harry Potter and other movies, in the forthcoming film Official Secrets, in which Keira Knightley plays Catherine Gunn. Who remembers who Catherine Gunn is? Kathy Kelly does. Catherine Gunn was the employee of the British government who risked prison to make public the fact that the U.S. government had recruited the British government to help blackmail other governments into voting for the 2003 war on Iraq. Emerson defended Gunn with the argument that she had acted out of necessity of preventing the crime of war. And the British government backed down on prosecuting her because it would have been forced to reveal documentation that its own opinion was that the war would be a crime, a revelation that might have led to prosecutions of Tony Blair and members of his government. Yet all of that information has since been made public, and not a single person has been prosecuted. The UN Charter not only makes war a crime, but it makes the threat of war, including the long-standing White House mantra, all options are on the table, a crime. It does something else, though. It gives the UN the power to impose economic sanctions. This often brutal tool has led to massive death and suffering and laid the groundwork for wars. However, the Fourth Geneva Convention, which, for whatever it's worth, came after the UN Charter, bans the use of collective penalties. That law is apparently not hard to ignore, and the Geneva Conventions in general may be the most frequently ignored laws in the world. Number 8, the U.S. presidency has been given imperial powers. It is the opinion not only of the current president and of Richard Nixon that anything a president does is legal. It is also the opinion of the U.S. Congress and of much of the U.S. public that a U.S. president is entitled to vastly more power than was ever held by King George III. This includes the power of nuclear holocaust. A couple of years ago, when Trump was threatening North Korea with, quote, fire and fury, a congressional committee held a hearing on the question of how Congress could prevent a president from launching a nuclear war. All members and witnesses were in agreement. They were utterly powerless to control the emperor. Of course, you and I might think, and some Congress members might agree, that a president could be removed for incompetence under the 25th Amendment, or might be impeached for numerous public and indisputable offenses, including, oh, I don't know, profiting from his office, incitement of violence, interference with voting rights, discrimination based on religion, illegal wars, illegal threats of nuclear war, abuse of pardon power, failure to reasonably prepare for or respond to Hurricanes Harvey and Maria, separating children and infants from their families, refusing to comply with subpoenas, declaring emergency without basis in order to violate the will of Congress, illegally proliferating nuclear technology, and illegally removing the United States from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, and so forth. We might think Congress perfectly capable of banning first use of nuclear weapons, or banning presidential use of nuclear weapons, or banning the possession of nuclear weapons, all of which simply proves that we are not qualified to testify before Congress. One way that you are all very familiar with, I am sure, to restrain presidential wars is for the Congress to ban particular wars or to insist that every particular war be authorized by Congress, as required by the U.S. Constitution. The House recently passed a ban on a war on Iran and an end to the U.S. war in the U.S. role in the war on Yemen, and an end, in fact, to the Korean War after all these years. And I am in favor of all of those things. I am in favor of anything Congress or anybody else can do to prevent any war, including shouting, presidents can't start wars. But here's what I'm not in favor of and what amounts to a pretense that war is legal. It's become very common for peace advocates to oppose, quote, unauthorized wars, or any wars not authorized by Congress. This is a little bit odd. Surely nobody is against the torture of kittens only if it's unauthorized by Congress. Since when does Congress get to authorize crimes? And what would make those crimes any less horrific if Congress did authorize them? If the U.S. government were to launch a war against Illinois, forgetting that the indigenous people and the British are gone now, which sounds crazy unless you recall that Trump believes the American revolutionaries took over all the airports, if that were to happen, would you really care whether Illinois was being bombed by a president or by a Congress? I have yet to hear a single victim of U.S. wars anywhere on earth complain that the wars were not properly authorized by the U.S. Congress. The demand that Congress vote on each war has to some extent replaced the demand that each war be ended. Congress members and some of their constituents prefer to demand a proper vote than to express an opinion on which way that vote should go. The implication is that either way would be legal and acceptable. I once questioned Senator Tim Kaine on this point. He was going on and on about how Trump shouldn't bomb Syria without Congress. And I asked him how Congress could possibly make bombing Syria legal given the existence of the UN Charter. His response, which you can watch on my YouTube channel, was that Congress could do nothing to make some wars legal. But 30 seconds later, and ever since, he just went right back to talking as he had before, denouncing Trump for not coming to Congress to legalize those wars. Some in Britain want to require that the Parliament support any new war. The upside, of course, would be any successful prevention of a war by the Parliament. The trouble, of course, is that the Parliament might then assume that it has the legal right to commit the crime of war. The U.S. Congress in 1973 created something called the War Powers Resolution, which violates or weakens the Constitution by allowing presidents to launch wars for up to 60 days in the event of, quote, a national emergency created by attack upon the United States, its territories or possessions, or its armed forces. Of course, that's not good enough for emperors. Harold Coe, lawyer for Obama, informed Congress that bombing Libya would not be a war or even hostilities. And so even the War Powers Resolution would not apply. I sincerely hope that if I am ever bombed, it is with non-hostile bombs. Number 7, just war theory. Back when Christianity became the religion of an empire instead of the religion persecuted by an empire, people like Ambrose and Augustine had to explain to everybody why Jesus would have wanted them to join in organized mass killing. Some sects of Christianity have never accepted violence to this day. But the theories of the ancient saints as to how war could be just have saturated Western culture and made their way into the minds of us all. We're talking about the theories of people who in some cases believed that killing non-Christians was of no concern whatsoever, while killing Christians was a service because you were sending them to a better place. The theories concocted to justify war come out of assumptions and worldviews that most of us don't share. They also make no sense on their own terms. The criteria that a war must meet to be deemed just are either amoral, impossible, or immeasurable. No war victim cares whether a war was launched by a proper authority. No war has ever been launched as a last resort. Last resort simply means that one has stopped thinking or trying ideas. No claim of proportionality has ever been measured on a scale to determine whether it is correct or not, because every such claim is simply invented out of thin air. If you say it's okay to bomb a location if no more than 49 civilians will die, and I say no more than 3, and somebody else says no more than 2,000,016, there is no way to determine who is right. But there is also no way to get governments and lawyers to stop claiming that murders should be proportional. There is no way in a modern war to keep non-combatants immune from attack as required by just war theory. Non-combatants are the vast majority of the victims in modern wars. There is no way to respect enemy soldiers while killing them, not in my worldview. I'm happy to be respected in many, many ways, but none of them coexist with killing me. No war can ever meet the criteria for these ancient theories. But any war that could would still fail dramatically to justify maintaining the institution of war, which generates the risk of nuclear disaster, including complete apocalypse, imposes huge destruction on the natural environment, fuels hatred and bad government, and kills first and foremost through the diversion of resources away from human and environmental needs. Yet, we have human rights groups like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch that, as a matter of principle, refuse to recognize laws against war and embrace the distinction between ad bellum and in bello, between why a war is begun and how it is conducted. The former is ignored as a matter of principle, while the latter is scrutinized. One of the most embarrassing sophistries of just war theory is the use of the concept of intentionality, and it survives to this day. If a military expects an action to kill a large number of civilians, but also to accomplish some other purpose, it can just choose to think of the action as intending that other purpose. In this way, the killings become unintended or collateral damage. The Convention on the Prohibition of Military or any other hostile use of environmental modification techniques forbids major environmental destruction, as could be expected from, say, bombing fossil fuel or nuclear facilities. But if the intention is said to be some military purpose, then the predictable environmental damage becomes legal because it's unintended. Despite all of these tricks, many people recognize most wars as unjust, yet hold out the possibility of some future war being just and of one particular past war, about which they are badly misinformed, and you all know which one it is, having been just. Just war thinking in our culture, in fact, focuses around a belief in the eventual second coming of Adolf Hitler, who is, of course, not on his way. Number six, treaties are not just ignored and violated, but also torn up and rejected, generating enemies and avoiding disarmament. I mentioned the acceptance of presidential nuclear powers and what might be done about it, including the radical idea of getting rid of nukes. But that radical idea is a legal requirement. By joining the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty in 1970, the then nuclear-armed nations committed to not transferring nuclear weapons to other nations or in any way encouraging other nations to acquire nuclear weapons. The United States keeps nuclear weapons in other nations and has given nuclear technology to other nations. Also, by joining that treaty, every member committed to undertaking, quote, to pursue negotiations in good faith on effective measures relating to cessation of the nuclear arms race at an early date, and to nuclear disarmament, and on a treaty of general and complete disarmament under strict and effective international control, end quote. How are those good faith efforts to accomplish that at an early date looking a half century later? The world has 14,000 nuclear bombs, some of them thousands of times the size of what destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the United States and Russia have 13,000 of those 14,000. The United States government has gone out of its way to avoid disarmament or any sort of cooperation with Russia. Russia, I wish it were needless to say, commits its own war crimes, not to mention other outrages. But it is the United States that has led the opposition to compliance with the Non-Proliferation Treaty. When Gorbachev wanted to give up all nuclear weapons, Ronald Reagan refused to give up his Star Wars program. When Germany reunited, the United States and its allies lied to the Russians that NATO would not expand. Then NATO quickly began expanding eastward. Meanwhile, the United States openly bragged about imposing Boris Yeltsin and corrupt crony capitalism on Russia by interfering in a Russian election in collusion with Yeltsin. NATO developed into an aggressive global war maker and expanded right up to Russia's borders, where the United States began installing missiles. Russian requests to join NATO or Europe were dismissed out of hand. Russia was to remain a designated enemy, even without communism and even without constituting any threat or engaging in any hostility. After Clinton bombed Kosovo despite Russia's veto at the UN, he refused Putin's offer to reduce each nation's arsenal to 1,000 bombs. George W. Bush withdrew and Congress let him from the anti-ballistic missile treaty. Obama put new missile bases in Romania and Poland. Trump is completing the one in Poland. Bush and Obama and Trump rejected Russian and Chinese proposals to ban weapons in space, and Obama rejected Russia's proposal to ban cyber attacks. The U.S. Congress has refused to join Russia and most of the world's governments in ratifying the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. When Russia gave the U.S. a memorial in sorrow for the victims of 9/11, the United States practically hid it and reported on it so little that most people don't know it exists or believe it is fake news. Obama and Trump expelled Russian diplomats and Congress sanctioned them. Obama helped facilitate a coup in Ukraine and Trump began shipping weapons to the coup government. Obama tried to overthrow the government of Syria and Trump escalated the bombings, even bombing Russian troops. Russia is accused and found guilty prior to convincing evidence of shooting down an airplane, aggressively flying near U.S. planes on Russia's borders, and of conquering Crimea through a popular vote, of poisoning people in England, of torturing and murdering a man in prison, and of course of hacking an election, an accusation which, if evidence is ever produced for it, will amount to far less than Israel does in the United States or than the United States does in dozens of countries. And through all of these accusations, it is not uncommon for the Russians to be referred to as the commies, despite the demise of communism. And now Trump has abandoned the INF Treaty, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. The INF Treaty was signed by Reagan in 1987 and ratified by the U.S. Senate in 1988, becoming the supreme law of the land. The INF Treaty allows withdrawal only if, quote, extraordinary events related to the subject matter of this treaty have jeopardized its supreme interests. The INF Treaty provides for intrusive on-site inspections backed up by mutual verification by satellite and other monitoring mechanisms and a special verification commission to resolve any disputes about whether violations have occurred. Whether or not Russian development and deployment of its new 9M729 missile constitutes a material breach of the treaty is a matter to be dealt with by the provisions of the treaty itself and cannot satisfy the legal requirement for withdrawal. Trump has violated the treaty and the U.S. Constitution by withdrawing. 2 years ago, the majority of the world's nations supported the creation of a new treaty to ban all nuclear weapons. 70 have signed and 25 have ratified. The good faith efforts are now being imposed on the nuclear nations from outside of them, and not a moment too soon, with the U.S. president reportedly wanting to use nuclear weapons against hurricanes. Number five, we allow secret agencies to plan and fight wars, and media outlets ignore wars. We don't see horrors that we would immediately denounce as crimes. Every government on earth, beginning with the U.S., should shut down and be done with secret agencies, spy agencies, agencies used for murder, torture, bribery, election manipulation, and coups. While these agencies prevent the public from knowing what is being done in its name, they do not acquire any knowledge that benefits the public and that could not have been acquired openly, lawfully, through simple research, diplomacy, and law enforcement actions that respect human rights. While these agencies occasionally succeed in their criminal enterprises on their own terms, those successes always create blowback that does far more damage than the good, if any, accomplished. The CIA and all of its relatives in the U.S. government and around the world have normalized lying, spying, murdering, torturing, government secrecy, government lawlessness, distrust of foreign governments, distrust of one's own government, distrust of one's own qualifications to participate in self-government, and acceptance of permawar. Labeling terrorism counterterrorism doesn't make it something other than terrorism. And it doesn't change the fact that it increases rather than decreases terrorism by others. We should do something that Woodrow Wilson never did, and that is to take seriously the first of his 14 points. What was Woodrow Wilson's first point? open covenants of peace openly arrived at, after which there shall be no private international understandings of any kind, but diplomacy shall proceed always frankly and in the public view. Good idea. This is as critical a democratic reform as public financing of elections or public counting of paper ballots. Annie Jacobson's latest book is called Surprise, Kill, Vanish: The Secret History of CIA Paramilitary Armies, Operators, and Assassins. It is based on interviews with former top members of the CIA who simply adore the CIA. The book simply adores the CIA, and yet it remains a chronicle of endless, disastrous failure after failure after failure. This is a collection of pro-CIA voices leaking super top extra special secret information, much of it over 50 years old, and yet there is not a speck of justification for the CIA's existence to be found. We need to abolish the idea that secret government serves some useful purpose and is acceptable. Number four, the good war problem. The United States has a good war problem, a problem called the good war. We don't believe in good slavery or good rape or humanitarian child abuse. There are some things that we believe must be ended, not mended. But we have not only a faith in the possibility of the good war, of bombing for peace and justice, but a requirement, a strong requirement to believe in the existence of good wars. When the war on Vietnam became too unpopular, it became necessary to find a way to oppose that particular war without opposing the institution of war. So World War II was held up as the good war. When the war on Iraq became very unpopular, a man here in Chicago named Barack Obama declared that he was against it as a dumb war. He and many others quickly settled on their chosen candidate for the smart war and the good war, and it was the war on Afghanistan. While peace activists had denounced the war on Afghanistan from before it began, now it became common to hear that Afghanistan was in every way unlike Iraq. Wonderful, heroic, dedicated peace activists maintained that the United Nations had authorized the attack on Afghanistan, apparently based purely on the grounds that the United Nations had not authorized the attack on Iraq. If it didn't authorize the Iraq war, it simply must have authorized the Afghanistan war. So there is now a novel way in which to legalize a war in the United States, and it is this: start another war that's worse. Number three, the near total absence of consequences. While occasionally low-ranking members of the military are punished for particular atrocities, there is no accountability for those who launch wars or commit crimes within wars unless they are African. The International Criminal Court has now said that it will prosecute the crime of aggressive war. Heretofore, it has only prosecuted what are called war crimes. The very concept of war crimes serves to falsely suggest the legality of war itself. We don't have lynching crimes for those occasions when some element of a lynching is carried out improperly. We don't have mass shooting crimes for those moments when a mass shooter, somewhere within the country that matters, conducts some part of his mass shooting incorrectly. Yet we have war crimes for the bits of wars that are done wrong. Yet even those are only prosecuted by the ICC when the accused is from Africa. Attempts in countries like Spain and Belgium to prosecute U.S. war crimes under universal jurisdiction have been quashed by pressure from the U.S. government. Attempts by the International Court of Justice to hold the U.S. responsible for war crimes in places like Nicaragua have simply been ignored by the U.S. government. The war crimes of recent decades, the spying without warrant, the imprisoning without trial, the torture, etc., are ceasing to be crimes. U.S. citizens are just as spied on as they once thought it would be okay to spy on so-called enemies. Imprisoning without trial has transitioned from Guantanamo to the mainland and is now being proposed for immigrants. Torture was always here, just ask the Chicago police, but it has spread around the world and throughout our culture. In 2009, Michael Haas wrote a book with a foreword by Ben Ferenz, the only prosecutor from Nuremberg now living, and it listed 296 war crimes committed by George W. Bush. The first was the crime of aggressive war. Of the other 295 crimes, 253 of them were related to the treatment of prisoners and the treatment of an occupied population. This is why I say the Geneva Conventions may be the most ignored laws around. Of course, what happens when war crimes are not prosecuted or accounted for through truth and reconciliation or any such process is that they continue. And they are continued with minor variations by emperors from both political parties, thereby rendering them more acceptable to loyal members of those parties. Crimes become normalized. They're too big and widespread and even glorified and celebrated for us to see them as crimes and their architects as unindicted criminals. Number two, exceptionalism. Who gets a license to violate laws that nobody else gets to violate? The police do. If you convince yourself that you are the police, then you can violate more laws, remain outside more treaties, invest in more war making, engage in more bombings and invasions than anybody else in the name of restraining and punishing rogue regimes. You have a government, they have regimes. They engage in aggression, you have preemption. Their crimes justify yours, but yours aren't crimes at all. According to U.S. media outlets, the U.S. has not only a right to kill people anywhere as needed, but can suffer as the victim of aggression and respond with defense anywhere. So that Syrian attacks on U.S. troops in Syria have been generally referred to as Syrian aggression, as have interactions between U.S. and Russian planes near the border of Russia, been called Russian aggression. In 2015, a CNN presidential primary debate moderator asked this question, quote, "We're talking about ruthless things tonight. Carpet bombing, toughness, war. And people wonder, could you do that? Could you order airstrikes that would kill innocent children? Not by the scores, but by the hundreds and the thousands? Could you wage war as the commander in chief?" End quote. If a recording were obtained of a North Korean or Venezuelan or Iranian leader declaring his willingness to kill thousands of children, that would be not only cause for great outrage, but also grounds for bombing the offending nation, thereby in fact killing thousands of children, which is not a crime when a U.S. president does it. In fact, it is a basic duty of every president, according to CNN. Exceptionalism, of course, is a close sibling of racism and xenophobia and fuels and is fueled by them. U.S. exceptionalism is adopted by other nations that become complicit in U.S. crimes. Ireland is a neutral nation. Under Hague Convention 5, enforced since 1910, quote, belligerents are forbidden to move troops or convoys of either munitions of war or supplies across the territory of a neutral power. End quote. But the U.S. sends troops and weapons through Shannon Airport by the millions. I asked Ireland's ambassador to the United States how that could be legal. And she replied that she had asked the U.S. government and they'd told her it was. And the number one way in which we pretend that war is not a crime is, drumroll, normalization. Our entertainment, our education, our mass media, our politics treat violence, often extreme and sadistic violence, as normal and unremarkable, and participation in war as an admirable and praiseworthy service, completely regardless of whether the war participated in is an evil, murderous catastrophe. It has gotten so bad that many people cannot imagine a world beyond war. What do we do about this? One thing we can do is normalize a culture of peace. Once upon a time, the Kellogg-Briand Pact was displayed in post offices and classrooms. Once upon a time, Veterans Day was Armistice Day. At World Beyond War, we have just published a peace almanac with an important peace event for each day of the year. You can guess what it has for August 27th. We need to celebrate the work of peace activists, including those who've written essays being honored here today, and including the outlawists of the 1920s. We need to see examples of principled, nonpartisan, moral, fearless, strategic, and successful activism, like what created the Peace Pact. We also need to educate people about the possibility and the necessity of ending war. We need to work on projects that weaken the institution of war and strengthen structures of peace. At World Beyond War, we are successfully moving local governments to divest from weapons industries. And we're supporting campaigns to prevent and close military bases. We're also spreading the message of ending war and envisioning a world beyond it with books and videos and events. Some of the best events that I recommend doing are friendly debates between supporters and opponents of war. We need more people to use the books, articles, courses, and videos on worldbeyondwar.org and to sign the Declaration of Peace that is there and that is on the table to my left. We need to cure exceptionalism through changing our thinking, through learning about and respecting the other 96% of humanity, where the other 50% of the guns and prisons are. We need to create standards of holding criminals accountable even when they are guilty of the supreme international crime. This may require democratizing the United Nations or empowering national governments to hold the United States to basic standards. But we can begin small. When Dick Cheney planned to come to my town, I asked the local police to arrest him for torture. He never came. We need to make open and public government and foreign relations a basic demand in our platform and reforms alongside clean elections and fair taxes and sustainable energy. We need to learn enough about war to reject the notion of a good one. We need to learn enough about the history of abolishing war so that the Kellogg-Briand Pact is known by everyone. And this day as a global holiday, and we dedicate ourselves to completing the project that was advanced by the outlawists. Thank you.
Now, I value that historical perspective because I wasn't aware of the implications of the Kellogg-Briand Pact. It highlights for me the way that the powers that be can just sidestep law, history, precedent, or other social legacy if they are driven by stronger desires and they have the tools which allow them to get away with it. Now, war is pretty much the apex of hostility, zero-sum relations, predicated on the aim of destroying other people and apparently also destroying ecosystems and so on into the boot nowadays. What is it that motivates people to do such a thing? Why do they feel that their well-being is related to others' ill-being? Is that possibly an outworking of the money system? Let's recall from episode 617.
The more we make decisions in terms only of cost, the less practiced we become at making decisions any other way. You could say our thinking becomes demoralized, that moral thinking is something we can't do because we don't do it. Those decisions are too hard. We have no process. So we walk past them. And in refusing to engage with the social, moral, and political issues at stake, we affirm the status quo of the marketplace.
Now, I've been thinking about a moneyless world quite a lot throughout my life. And could we still have money in a sort of universal basic income? Can we get rid of predatory capitalism and still keep money? This is my thoughts from 735.
Money could still perhaps exist as a gift economy, but isn't it somehow an expression of the left brain's desire to want to quantify, understand, and control everything, to reduce the spontaneity, the variety, the whirl of confusion that is real life to a one-dimensional shadow, to mathematics that can be maximized, quantified. So even leaving aside issues such as the fact that the system's controlled by psychopaths, I think in a real sense, a world in which money plays an important part is a left-center dominated world.
In 642, Daniel Swalo is asked whether money is evil.
No. Money is illusion. Illusion is neither good nor evil. Attachment to illusion is evil. Attachment to illusion is called idolatry. Few will even question what money really is, because it's so pervasive, like air. Yet, unlike air, money does not exist outside the mind, but is only pervasive in the mind. unless we get into deeper Buddhist philosophy, which points out that all things arise from mind. Contrary to common definitions, money is not gold or silver, cowrie shells or cattle. Money is not bills, it's not credit card, it's not numbers in a bank or tabulations on paper. Money is purely belief in the head. Money exists no place else but in the mind. Money is a strange phenomenon that exists only because two or more people believe it exists. Where two or more are gathered in the belief of money, money is in their midst. To say that I live without money isn't saying anything, really. It's like saying I live without belief in Santa Claus. Now, if we lived in a world where everybody believed in Santa Claus, you might think I'm stepping out on a limb to live without Santa Claus, who never existed. But what if we saw gold for what it is? Gold is pretty, but virtually useless in most cases. Somebody decided it had an inflated worth, and everybody decided to believe this decision. Now a few people see gold for its reality, but they see fictitious values. Natives in North America thought Europeans were utterly insane because of their lust for such a useless yellow substance. What if we spent as much of our wealth and energy on living beings as we do on guarding and revering gold bars at Fort Knox? Gold bars which do nothing, gold bars which don't hear, don't see, don't smell, don't taste, and don't speak, and which provide neither food nor clothing nor shelter nor warmth to a single living being. What if we spent as much of our wealth and energy on living beings as we do on guarding and revering pieces of paper and coins, as well as numbers in databases which do absolutely nothing, which don't hear, don't see, don't smell, don't taste, and don't speak, which provide neither food nor clothing nor shelter nor warmth to a single living being? And there's a quote from the Book of Psalms. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. They have mouths, but they do not speak. Eyes they have, but they do not see. They have ears, but they do not hear. Noses they have, but they do not smell. They have hands, but they do not handle. Feet they have, but they do not walk. Nor do they mutter through their throat. Those who make them are like them. So is everyone who trusts in them. Imagine that you had eyes that saw reality rather than your own belief. Imagine if you saw a $100 bill as a piece of paper with a pretty work of art on it, and nothing else. Our real selves live without money, always have, and always will. Only our pretend selves can live with and use and own money. Don't get me wrong, that's not even saying that money is evil, or that to pretend is evil. But when we think our pretense is reality, this is when we've sunk into disaster. Think about this, please. I'm tired of living in the pretend world that thinks itself real. I'm tired of being a pretense. People of commerce often tell children and people like us to get real, to join the real world. Now I want you to reconsider who is really in the real world. Really consider this, please. It's kind of funny how those most attached to money always tell me emphatically, money is not the root of all evil, but the love of money is the root of all evil, quoting 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 10. If only they believe what has just come out of their own mouths. People get emphatic about defending what they most love.
547. Now, roll on the day, everybody feels free to ask themselves, what is the point? Why am I doing this? What are the long-term consequences of what I'm doing? As we've seen before on the show, the hierarchical nature of society means there's typically very few people who are able to ask that question. Often psychopathic or with sociopathic tendencies towards the top of the hierarchy, most people's freedom of choice is just limited to how can I carry out the orders that I've been given.
I think the task that we face is to return to an understanding of the world in which people are understood to do what they think is the right thing, in which it's not acceptable to try to seek power over people, whether through legal, economic, or other means. The logic of the money system, as we've seen before, concentrates wealth in fewer and fewer hands, and that same logic, if it says you're only entitled to houses if you have the ability to pay, and payment must be in this currency, which is a private monopoly issued for the gain of those who control the system, that logic says, well, okay, you guys don't deserve a house, we deserve to take all your property. The first step is to see the fundamental injustice of that kind of thinking, tracing its effect on our other ideas, also a complex one. As an example, do you have a moral right to something because you can pay for it? Do you have no moral right to something because you can't pay for it? These are questions which we are not often encouraged to ask, but I would encourage you, as a step towards understanding what you believe as right and wrong, and going outside of prescribed hierarchies of what you are told to do, what you are told not to do, is an uncertain thing, but I think not as uncertain as the future which awaits us if we continue blindly to follow orders. We've seen before what perils await unless we as a people can change directions. Now I'm going to leave the closing word to Charles Eisenstein. This is from his Ascent of Humanity, which is available for download from our website as an audiobook. He's elaborating on the larger picture, humans' fear-driven alienation from the world and desire for control, and of course the intimate connection with the money system.
Life under contract. The tyranny of yes and no, the migration of life to a wholly domesticated realm, and the dwindling of the uncertain and undefined in favor of the expressly permitted and explicitly forbidden takes another form in laws, rules, and regulations. Here, the program of control manifests as a spreading legalism that infiltrates all aspects of modern life. In the ecological sphere, the shrinking of the wild is domestication, confinement, and the great indoors. In the personal sphere, it's the conquest of the child's spontaneity and creativity. In the social sphere, it is the codification of previously informal agreements, ethics, and mores. As legal scholar Paul Campos puts it, anyone who compares the legal domains of our society to those of the pre-modern state immediately becomes aware of a tremendous and ever-increasing contraction of formally unregulated social space. Close quote. Our dependence on authority to delimit the realm of the permissible projects onto the collective level as the urge to regulate, to medicalize, juridify, and police every act of labor or play. Thanks to our schooling, we are accustomed to being told what is allowed, accustomed to authority determining right and wrong, and accustomed to coercive enforcement of these distinctions. Implicit in a world under control is that if something goes wrong, it must be someone's fault. Someone must bear legal responsibility. Someone must be punished, and I should be compensated. And so, children in authoritarian institutions such as schools resolve disputes by telling on each other, going to teacher, the source of authority. In religion, the same tendency manifests in the idea of God as a referee who will reward the just, punish the wicked, and make everything fair in the end. In law, this attitude motivates the burgeoning realm of the regulated, the ever-increasing contraction of formally unregulated social space, and our endemic reliance on lawsuits to resolve disputes.
And note that anything hierarchical, such as money or law, anything which is easy to mechanize, is left brain culture, unifical, avoids ambiguity, avoids multiple meanings, and on a practical level, if we're human beings handing out the magic beans, the tokens that we pay so much attention to, and we don't allow that opportunity to any of the other organisms on the planet, then it's a way of looking inwards. We look at our own navel. We don't look at the real world. We don't relate to those organisms. Maybe they have their own systems, which are important to them. How could we, as individuals, as a culture, come to share this delusion? Is it perhaps related to death anxiety, which we looked at in episode 726?
American utopianism at the moment tends to be consumer utopia. It's associated with money and the ability to command the wills of other people by paying them something, which in effect is a magnifying your own self. It's magnifying your own strength. If you can potentially make anyone in the world do your bidding because of your checkbook, then in effect you have everyone in the world extending your power. You have millions of hands and arms.
Wealth is a kind of symbolic barrier against death. And I think unconsciously we think, you know, if I have enough of it, it isn't going to get me. I can buy my way clear of this.
The tragic flip side of this experience is that if you don't have money, you're in effect surrendering your ability to choose or to control other people. Or to put it another way, you're radically vulnerable. The ultimate state of being without money is to be a slave.
When you don't have $1 zillion, whose fault is it in the U.S. of A.? It's your fault, and you feel like a piece of crap. It's not surprising that a third of the American population is depressed.
Well, if you don't have money, it makes you a slave. With that simple thought, we just enslaved the natural world. What about the fact that banks create money not by giving it, but by lending it into existence? So the net amount of money in the world is negative. We're running on a treadmill to keep up. And that's before we even looked at the extreme concentration of wealth. This is from 537.
Look at things like economic literacy as being the part of money system iceberg which is above the surface, which is explicitly saying we are here to try and encourage people to think about the world in terms of money, in terms of the zero sum, the selfish maximization, and underneath that is a huge story of people's values being shaped by the system in the developed world, which most of them use innumerable times on any given day.
Now, for most people, that is lots of small transactions. Let's hear another example. This is the now retired director of the NSA, Bill Binney, reporting about reaction in organizations to the September the 11th attacks.
Your colleague was told by higher-ups at the NSA to not embarrass large companies affiliated with the intelligence failure, and that if you do your part, you'll earn
get
your share.
Right.
And saying that they could milk the cow for 15 years. Now, yes. Bill, this seems like a very odd thing to say in the immediate wake of the most devastating terrorist attack on U.S. soil.
Well, you see, the focus is on getting money, and that's the reason they say those kinds of things. It's not to fix the problem. The point is to keep the problem going so they keep asking for more money.
There wasn't a moment of reckoning?
Not among greedy people, no. And that include the management of NSA.
I mean, what was your response to this when you were in the
halls?
I mean,
my response is testimony in their various places that they traded the security of the people of the United States and the free world for money. I mean, they still have the same problem. They haven't changed a thing.
Now, for an alternative vision of how society might work, let's hear from episode 688.
Going moneyless is a gateway to connection, intimacy, adventure, and an authentic experience of life. Far from being a path of sacrifice to qualify oneself as good, it is a path of joy and, dare I say it, a path of wealth.
600.
Vinoba Bhave was named by Gandhi as sort of his official successor. Now, post-independence in India, Vinoba did something incredible. He realized that there was a lot of inequity in the country, and he wanted to solve it. Sounds a little familiar. So he decides to go on a walking pilgrimage. He goes from village to village. And in each village, he tells the rich landowners to donate 1/6 of their land to the poor landowners. No coercion, no compulsion, just purely for the spirit of generosity. Right? He appealed to their inner transformation. He ended up walking 70,000 kilometers. And through those 70,000 kilometers, more than 5 million acres of land was just donated. That's twice the size of Lebanon. That's almost as big as Israel. And all he did was he would go from in a village, inspire these people, and go on to the next. It ended up being the largest peaceful transfer of land in human history. We call it giftivism. The practice of radically generous acts that changed the world. And the marker of giftivism is that it's for the 100%. There is no enemy, there is
now,
no...
Now, in case you're thinking, ah, but that's not how the world works, let's have a quick thought experiment. If you were, say, I don't know, stuck in a lift with a stranger and you couldn't get out and you had a meal, would you share it, even if it was your meal? What would you think of him if he ate it in front of you and didn't offer anything? What would you think if it had been 3 days since you ate? So that's an open question, and the answer to that might depend on how much you'd been exposed to economics and business. What about if it was a village? Would you put up with starving people in your village? Would you feed them? If you didn't feed them and look after them, you might find yourself coming down with the very same diseases that they caught because of their diminished health. Would you need laws about whose responsibility it was to do what? Or would you say, well, I got plenty of food, this guy could obviously use a meal? Is it inconceivable to you that there might be lots of hungry people, although there's also lots of food? Well, it still puzzles me, but that's the world we live in. This is a point we're going to look at later. This is Marvin Bram's comments on how unifical societies, hierarchies, put such a distance between the people who make the decisions and the people who implement the decisions. We continue with 735. Now, I should refer new listeners at this stage to episode number 523, when Ivan Illich predicts a sudden collapse of the illusion of social power. I suggest that that might be exactly coincident with a mass turning away from the money system in favour of more democratic and more truly representative systems of aligning offers and requests. So to shift the focus slightly from finance onto what is referred to as financial security, on one level that does come down to violence. Let's hear the following quote from episode 511.
This is a film about why people feel the need to keep armies and fight wars. How we're all trying to get what we want, or at least make ourselves safe, through military power, and how none of us are succeeding.
593.
In a national security state that has eradicated all laws that prevent abuse of the public, whatever the state does is legal. To such a pass have we in America come, as a result of our long historic indoctrination and abject submission to our ruling class. To achieve any redemption for Americans, to make possible any more just, humane, and life-honoring society, will require complete abandonment of the system of predatory capitalism. It offers no prospect of reform or improvement, and we have all been witness to the absurdly corrupt idiocy of our so-called democratic process for generations.
On the story that more weapons and control technology is a path to security, episode 521.
After the events of 9/11 and the rush to war, the question came up, how much security do we need? How tight do we want to make the borders in the United States? How much surveillance should we do of people who come in from other countries with passports? Those questions naturally arose. How secure can we make the country, and how far do we want to go? Is there a balance with privacy? Is there a balance with freedom? And I think Derek and I came to the conclusion that it's a false choice, that privacy is actually an illusion. It's a distraction from bigger questions about who's got power over who. And it's a distraction from the larger question of freedom and power and how society is constructed and how we live our lives. And as we looked at the historical record, we discovered some pretty shocking things. I mean, criminals in, you know, at least from the Middle Ages on, criminals were often tattooed, or they'd even have their ears docked to mark them as criminals. It was a way of identifying people, sorting people, branding people. And about the time in the 1800s, early 1800s, when this began to be frowned upon, democracy was rising and political revolutions, you know, 1848, there were revolutions in Europe. The harsh treatment of prisoners and poor people began to be frowned on. And about this time, fingerprints were discovered. People had unique fingerprints. And also, about this time, photography was invented. And within 10 years of the invention of photography, over 500,000 gypsies had been photographed in Europe. People that were itinerant, they traveled around, they didn't hold jobs, they didn't have property, they weren't under anybody's control. But within a decade of the invention of photography, over 500,000 of them had been photographed in Germany and in Switzerland especially, but in other countries also. And those photographs were put in a file so that they could be tracked. And if there were crimes committed, you know, a database of people that were suspect could be searched. And we discovered that with passports, with any kind of identification, whether it's criminal, it soon becomes applied to the population at large. Passports begin to be used. Any time there's a war, the security apparatus gets cranked up, and then after the war, it never goes away. So passports were used first as a wartime measure, and often to keep draft-age young men from leaving the country. Passports were originally used to keep people from leaving the country rather than for people entering the country. But by the time of World War I, passports were required for travel in Europe between countries. After the war, those requirements were not lifted. And we see the same thing after 9/11. You know, the Patriot Act was first passed as a temporary emergency measure to protect the country in a time of war, and now, of course, those provisions are becoming permanent. So that's that obsession with security starts out usually during war, during times of crisis, and there's a rationale for it. We're afraid, and so we go for security over privacy and freedom. But with passing decades, we lose more and more of our freedom once something begins to be used, either politically or administratively or technologically, it tends to become a permanent feature of society.
If a lot of people are not happy with this technology, if the results do not appear to match the claimed purposes, then why don't people raise objections? Why do people implement this? Well, following orders and hierarchy explains why a lot of people do the things they do. Does this perhaps explain the very low rating of Congress? Does this perhaps explain how little confidence the US public have in Congress? Well, what about the people in Congress? How do they explain this to themselves? Are they perhaps in a tightly controlled informational bubble? Most of them are millionaires. That's going to shape their experience of the USA. It's going to be that much easier for them not to look down the social hierarchy and see what's actually on the ground, never mind the fact that I dare say many of them have not experienced much life outside of the USA. I might be wrong on that, perhaps it's my prejudice, but it seems to me because of their stratum in society, it's easy for, say, the supranational deep state to keep a watch on these people and to keep telling them what it wants them to know.
As you mentioned, there's barely anyone in Congress that has a different view on U.S. foreign policy, on curbing the surveillance state, curbing the police state. What is going on here? Why is no one able to see what we're seeing, Bill?
Well, because we're not members of the military intelligence complex or the shadow government. We're not members of that. So, you know, everybody in that environment is kind of, they're in their own bubble, okay?
So it's a combination effort. It's the fact that half of them are millionaires anyway, a lot of them wouldn't know the difference between black and white, and they have handlers who are intent on keeping them voting in the correct fashion through whatever means comes to hand. Lest we think this is really much of a change, let's hear Bill Davis from the Christic Institute. He's speaking in 1990 on congressional silence about drug dealing of the Iran-Contra operation.
Why didn't they speak out? Why didn't anybody, you know, really push this?
Well, bottom line is that the business of Congress is primarily getting reelected. You don't get reelected if you attack and expose the intelligence community. You don't get reelected if you offend the people who pay your campaign bills. And if those people are in league with certain bankers and certain drug dealers, hey, why dig up a can of worms when you don't have to? You can slide by talking about snow tires and, oh, isn't this awful, you misused money and you lied to Congress, a few kind of minor things. It'll look like, it'll give the appearance of the pursuit of justice. And so we have these public hearings that were televised, and it's all calculated to giving the appearance of something being done about it, when in fact, nothing was seriously done to wound this operation or even to expose what was behind the operation. That's why it's so important that we have something like the Christic Institute lawsuit. We're going after why these things were done, and we're trying to expose to the American public what these connections are so that they can judge for themselves who they want to elect, what kind of legal reforms they may want, what kind of laws to be passed. Do they want an intelligence community, for instance, that's in bed with drug dealers? And my guess is that once this gets exposed, a lot of Americans are going to say, you know, come on, we need intelligence, but we don't need that. And furthermore, we don't need an intelligence community that lies to the American public.
Everybody in that environment is kind of, they're in their own bubble, okay?
Everyone in Congress?
A good many of them, yeah. You must, at all costs, protect the program. Because if you don't, we lose power control and eventually money.
So I know that you said you don't link up to wireless networks and, you know, surveillance technology, but what do you say to the audience who just feels completely disillusioned at this point, saying, look, we have to incorporate some of our lives online? What are they supposed to do?
It's a matter of don't put anything out there that you don't want someone else to read.
But even speak at this point.
That too. Don't say anything you don't want anybody else to hear.
That's a pretty stark reality, isn't it?
Now, I say everything because I want them to hear, okay? Because I want them to know what I'm going to do in court.
Yeah, but what about people who want to protect their privacy?
Then you invent your own encryption and don't pass it through NIST because then they will have it. So you don't do that. You don't use anything publicly because they already got that.
And the encryption methodologies that are available now were the NSA was involved in constructing themselves.
Well, they also know the algorithms, all of them. They have the software for it. Because it has to run through NIST to do testing. They do the testing, and then they approve it for public use. So I say, hey, if you're talking to your little community, make your own encryption. You don't care. You're not doing this publicly. We're just doing it among ourselves. So that would cause them a real problem.
I don't consider that there's any real expectation of privacy amongst people who know how this technology works. The telecom laws used to prohibit collection of personal data, and the supranational deep state wasn't happy with that and completely flipped them. Now they have to keep personal data because the supranational deep state wants to take copies of it. So I've not got a lot of faith in laws to restrain what's going on. If you want, to put it another way, if you want to be black and tell people you're white, well, you can try. You've got to be pretty good at technology to avoid contrary evidence leaking out these days, and I think that's part of the weakness of the supranational deep state. They can pass all the laws and they can pass all the laws they want, but if people know, well, that's just because the supranational deep state control the legal process now, then they're undercutting their moral position. For a quick refresher course on rights, this is George Carlin from episode 570. About the internment of the ethnically Japanese citizens during World War II.
Just when these American citizens needed their rights the most, their government took them away. And rights aren't rights if someone can take them away. They're privileges. That's all we've ever had in this country is a bill of temporary privileges. And if you read the news even badly, you know that every year the list gets shorter and shorter and shorter. You see how sooner or later the people in this country are going to realize the government does not give a fuck about them. Government doesn't care about you or your children or your rights or your welfare or your safety. It simply doesn't give a fuck about you. It's interested in its own power. That's the only thing, keeping it and expanding it wherever possible. Personally, when it comes to rights, I think one of two things is true. I think either we have unlimited rights or we have no rights at all. Personally, I lean toward unlimited rights. I feel, for instance, I have the right to do anything I please. But if I do something you don't like, I think you have the right to kill me. So where are you going to find a fair deal in that? So the next time some asshole says to you, I have a right to my opinion, you say, oh yeah, well, I have a right to my opinion, and my opinion is you have no right to your opinion.
Now, security through superior technology, through mass surveillance, through weapons and laws which are hierarchically enforced, that's one way of looking at security. I think it's a zero-sum way. If I'm more secure, that makes someone else less secure. So it's a great business model. You can make money as long as people can be bothered to run an arms race. I prefer a model of security that was very familiar to me growing up as a child. I felt secure, surrounded by people who loved me. Is that an important area that we could look at in society at large? Should we perhaps be prioritizing that type of security and less on the military-industrial complex solution? What about if America started to export useful items to the rest of the world rather than weapons? Would that perhaps make America more secure? I think it would. I think a lot of people understand that. It's a rhetorical question, really. I've got to look at Charles Eisenstein's book on rights and community, codes of conduct, not punitive justice. If you were to live next door to somebody, if you can't put them in a metal box and throw the key away, I think people are more likely to reach just solutions than using an externally defined power hierarchy. These and many other concepts are explored in an audiobook by Charles Eisenstein named Ascent of Humanity, which Lynn read on the show, many episodes, that's available online. Let's hear Lynn now. This is from episode 487. She's explaining why she spent so much time of the show on Charles Eisenstein's book.
It is the regime of me and mine, the destruction of community, love, and beauty, and the passionate assertion of our rights to it and the necessity of it to living a meaningful life is for me the core topic of the book. To me, it is about restoring to human beings our stolen birthright to live freely and harmoniously with nature like other animals, to assert our natural right to food, water, shelter, and companionship that all creatures have and that all creatures can have only when we respect equally the birthrights of others.
Now, I've not seen any legal codification of what Lynn means by the birthrights of others. But I know what she's talking about. In a bigger picture sense, this is not a nationally left-brain, legally defined right that could be defined by a syllogism. It's a natural right, the same way we have laws of nature, laws of gravity, which are not dependent on national governments, and then we have national laws, which exist at some point in the mind, because it's what power hierarchy tells to do. When I was a kid, I didn't have a power hierarchy in the same way. Is that because I was primitive and not aware of how the world worked? Or is that because my brain was in a better balance? Do people sometimes, in extremis, change from following legal, mechanistic, standard operating procedure? Do they behave viscerally? I think the brain can shift very quickly between left and right. I'm not a neurologist, but it seems to me sort of global consciousness that is arising from an interconnected world is increasingly undercutting these arbitrarily defined hierarchies. We see how certain things are legal in certain places and other things are illegal. We see how national governments are confused between black and white. And could we perhaps think about rights, responsibilities, actions, how we will behave as creatures of this earth, not as consumers or citizens? 521.
If we're honest with ourselves, there's a lot of magical thinking going on now. We think the hydrogen engine is going to save us from fossil fuels. And we think some legislation to protect our privacy will protect us from the capabilities of computers to spy on people. And I think that's one of the problems with expecting an apocalyptic doom or a magical saving of the world, is that you begin to put your hopes in false options. The question of surveillance and control, the issues we were looking at in Welcome to the Machine, is one of the classic false hopes is privacy. In older cultures, there was no such thing as privacy. You lived in a village. You met maybe 100 or 200 people in your whole life. You knew everybody. You lived in a village or in a hunting and gathering band of 50 to 75 people, and everything was face-to-face. Everybody had essentially the same level of power. Some people were more skilled at some things than others. Some people were natural leaders. But everybody had essentially the same power. And if a leader got out of control, they were no longer the leader. And they didn't wield a huge technological advantage or a huge advantage in information. Someone didn't know more about you than you knew about them. Power relations never got unbalanced to any great degree. And that's just not true anymore. There are people that have vast wealth and vast power over others, and it's not reciprocal. So rather than looking at the technology or the particular crisis, I think it's more helpful in the long run to look at how society is arranged and how, even on the individual level, how am I living my life? How do I spend my time? Who do I give my money to? Whose rules do I follow? Ultimately, those are more useful questions. And the reliance on legislation, on reliance on someone else is going to pass a law that will help protect my civil rights. The whole idea of privacy never arose. Privacy was never necessary until power relations were unequal. And then suddenly I wanted certain areas of my life to be under my control. So I said, that's my private, that's my private privilege. But why is that even necessary unless I've already given up my own power to someone else?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's an interesting point. I wanted to say one thing that I got from the book is that I found it interesting that a high-ranking security chief in South Africa's apartheid regime, his greatest fear was not economic or industrial sabotage, but that people would be convinced to disregard law and order. And that was actually his greatest fear, he confessed later on. And I wonder if you can maybe talk about, when people hear all kinds of stuff like this, the question that people end up on is, well, what do we do? And for those people out there who are thinking, what do we do? And most of us already know what to do. But I'm curious to hear perspective on that. What ways are there out of this machine?
Yeah. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, another political scientist and philosopher in the 1700s, wrote that man is born free and everywhere he is in chains. The brain may become paralyzed and the individual still live. A man may remain an imbecile and still live. Slaves lose everything in their chains, even the desire of escaping them. If there are slaves, it is because they've enslaved themselves. A force made the first slaves, and cowardice perpetuates the situation. And there's another writer even earlier in the 1500s, La Boetie. He wrote an essay that's just incredibly inspiring. He points out that everywhere kings and generals, whoever's, think of the most powerful people on earth. How do they get the power? They're still people. I mean, in the end, we are still living with the same capabilities as those people in village life where everyone had equal power. I ultimately have as much power as Bill Gates or George Bush. The extent to which someone else has more power than I do is dependent on me granting them that power. Ultimately, you know, George Bush is a human with with one head and two arms and two legs. If he's going to send people to their death, it depends on soldiers obeying his commands. Even the soldiers in Iraq, we've got, 150,000 troops? But how many millions, how many tens of millions of people are there in Iraq? So people are ruled by their own consent. And that's true whether you're talking about the ballot box or you're talking about machine guns. Ultimately, soldiers have to obey orders. The population has to obey soldiers. You know, on the political level, on a legal level, on the administrative levels, which is where our minds usually are, that's not a very satisfying answer. You say, well, that's preposterous. George Bush has, you know, led this country into war. He's got power. Well, 2/3 of Americans were in favor of the invasion of Iraq. So do we blame George Bush or do we take responsibility for ourselves? And I think that's really why telling people that they already have freedom, they already have power, is scary. It's not a satisfying answer. We want to hear that somebody else with power is going to pass a law that's going to protect me. I don't want to hear that I'm already free and that I bear responsibility for living that way. We don't want to hear it, and we've got a million political and economic and social reasons why we can't exercise freedom and responsibility. But that's basically what freedom is. Security is slavery. Slavery to the rules. It's slavery to the military. It's slavery to surveillance. It's counterintuitive that living with an obsession for security is to condemn yourself to being a slave to a machine and to the social relations that machine requires. And freedom is responsibility. It means I've got to take responsibility for what I do for a living, for what I consume, for how I treat my neighbors, for how I elect my leaders and what I allow them to do. And, people shy away from that. People really like leaders and project their power onto leaders, which, of course, is where that power comes from. The power that George Bush or Bill Gates or Saddam Hussein, their power is everyone's power that's been projected. It's the public's power that the public has projected onto that leader. Leaders are not in power for a day longer than the public submits to them.
Well, that's a message worth spreading. You might want to drop that one into casual conversation sooner rather than later, I might suggest, since it's going to ring a bit hollow if we've created fleets of AI-controlled predator drones that can use DNA sniffing to detect who hasn't paid their taxes to the gold card holders in the secure compounds who set the drones up. So let's not go there.